Case number 25-1009. In re United States of America, petitioner. Ms. Patterson for the petitioner, Mr. Faraday for respondent Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Mustafa Al Hosawi, Mr. Engel for respondent Waleed Mohammed Salih Mubarak bin Adash.
Good morning, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, Melissa Patterson for the United States. At issue here is whether to give effect to the Secretary of Defense's determination that the alleged mastermind of the 9/11 attacks and two alleged co-conspirators should face a trial at which the jury would have the discretion to enter death sentences. The judge presiding over the military commission here voided that determination, refusing to allow the Secretary to withdraw from pretrial agreements that his subordinate convening authority had entered into 2 days earlier. That ruling was wrong. There are reasonable and very deeply felt disagreements about the best way forward in these prosecutions of extraordinary national significance, but the official to whom Congress entrusted that determination is the Secretary, and he has decided that rather than allow respondents to take a plea deal, we should move forward to trial. This court should issue a writ of mandamus to prevent the military commission from accepting the guilty pleas under a deal from which the Secretary has withdrawn and to clear the way to move forward with a trial against the respondents. I'm happy to start with whatever issue would be most helpful to the court, but given that the reviewing military court, the USCMCR, has already concluded that one of the two grounds on which the military judge invalidated the Secretary's withdrawal was clearly and indisputably incorrect, it may make sense to start with the remaining ground, and that's the temporal aspect, whether or not the Secretary's withdrawal 2 days after the subordinate convening authority came 2 days too late.
I'd like to start with adequacy of an alternative form of remedy. And the respondents say that under 10 U.S. Code Section 950G, because the respondents have waived any appeal, then the government would have the ability to petition for review in this court after sentencing to challenge the validity of the final judgment. Why isn't that a correct way to read the statute?
I think just a point of clarification, I think two other respondents, Mr. Mohammed and Mr. Hosawi, make that argument. Mr. Bin Adash has a different theory about how we could have gotten interlocutory review. But dealing with the 950G argument on its own terms, I think it's unclear under the statute that the United States could appeal after a waiver. There is a question of whether subsection D of 950G that talks about review of decisions that have been affirmed or set aside by the USCMCR can be reviewed by this court. Now, let's just assume that they are right and that subsection C would give us the right to challenge a conviction under subsection C there, we would still face enormous risk that we could not undo the done plea deals and convictions at that point. I think it's notable that in their filings, they nowhere forswear a double jeopardy challenge. They point to a provision of the Military Commissions Act 949H and suggest that maybe, only maybe, statutory jeopardy would attach later. But they nowhere say that the usual civilian analog rule that double jeopardy attaches at the moment you enter a plea is not something that they'll argue. So I think that there's, you know, even if we have some hypothetical or possible way to get to this court, it's very unclear that this court could actually at that point order the relief we seek, which is a trial.
Can you identify any authority in which, because the relief that you would seek if you were to petition this court after sentencing would be to set aside the plea because you had a right to withdraw that was not granted. And so if we were to grant that relief at that time, what authority is there that double jeopardy would prevent a subsequent prosecution? Because, I mean, I don't know all the ins and outs of military law, and it's not clear from the briefing, but, you know, there are certain acts, at least in the civilian courts, where jeopardy attaches when you swear a jury.
And so where
would jeopardy attach in this context that couldn't be undone?
That's an open question, Your Honor. But in the civilian context, jeopardy would attach the moment that the pleas are accepted by the judge. And this judge and this military commission is poised to accept their pleas. It is unclear we or this court could ever unwind it. If constitutional jeopardy attaches, we in this court would be powerless to retry them on these charges.
I don't understand how that works. I mean, in the civilian context, you have guilty pleas all the time, and it doesn't happen frequently, but it does happen from time to time that one or the other party breaches the agreement. And are you telling me that in the civilian case, if that happens, the only thing that can that the prosecution on a breach would be precluded from seeking to try the case?
I think that is often the case, Your Honor. I think there may be limited.
Can you cite me a case? Authority where that's happened?
I think the McIntosh and the Patterson cases and the briefs here say that. I can certainly follow up with more authority. I just want to step out.
Clarify, what do you mean when you say you think that's the case? You think that that's the case that that happens, or you think it's the case that double jeopardy bars the government from withdrawing after the defendant breaches a plea agreement? I just wanted to clarify what your response was.
And I'm not sure I understand the question, so I'm worried I won't provide clarification. I think our point is a simple one, that there is a risk that jeopardy will attach, constitutional jeopardy will attach, and that we or this court will not be able to unwind these pleas once accepted.
Ms. Patterson, why does constitutional jeopardy apply? I mean, the Fifth Amendment doesn't apply outside the territorial United States under Eisentrager. So is constitutional jeopardy even at issue?
It may or may not be, but we certainly will face challenges from the respondents that it does. As this court and Your Honor, I'm sure, is well aware, the exact bounds of which constitutional guarantees apply at Guantanamo Bay has been the subject of, let us say, frequent litigation in this court. I am not conceding the double jeopardy clause would apply, but I think it's notable that they have not said they won't raise that challenge. And I just want to take a step back and point to cases like the adequacy of alternative avenues for relief in al-Nashiri and Mr. Muhammad's own successful petition for mandamus to this court. In those cases, there was no question that the petitioner could get an appeal on the back end. Those cases were about judicial bias. Everyone agreed they had a clear appeal route. And everyone agreed that this court would have the power to throw out their convictions at the back end if there had been bias by the judges. This court nonetheless said that was not an adequate alternative avenue for relief because it would have been very hard on back end review to suss out all the ways in which potential judicial bias might have tainted that proceeding. Here, we have substantial doubt if we could even get to this court after convictions, and there will be substantial barriers or arguments that this court's hands are tied at that
point. But I think that the al-Nashiri argument is kind of apples and oranges. There, it wasn't adequate because we didn't think we would really be able to essentially adjudicate the claim. We wouldn't be able to assess whether the error is harmless or not because of all of the different ways that judicial bias could potentially manifest itself. Here, I don't think that you have an argument that we wouldn't be able to figure out whether the government really should have been able to withdraw from this based on the passage of time or occurrence of subsequent events, right?
But I think there is an open question as to whether or not this court would be able to do anything about it. The relief we're seeking is the ability to put respondents on trials for crimes that at that point they already would have pleaded guilty to. Even apart from constitutional jeopardy, I think at that point they would raise claims that they were so prejudiced by having pleaded guilty to these crimes that a fair trial at that point could not be conducted. So again, we think that this...
Let me ask you about that because... I'm sorry, is it okay? Defendants enter guilty pleas and then decide to appeal, raise ineffective assistance or counsel or something like that. And if those, you know, if that review were granted, maybe I think this is what I thought. I wasn't sure you were answering to Judge Wilkins, and I'm sorry I interrupted the confusing question, but I want to clarify this is what you were answering to Judge Wilkins, and that is what happens in that situation. If we grant review, it was ineffective assistance of counsel, so the plea agreement is vacated. Does the person walk or does the government get to try them?
I think if the person convicted is challenging and saying this trial was essentially a nullity, then yes, you can retry them. If it is the government appealing a conviction...
This was a nullity. This plea was a nullity.
I think that because it would be the government appealing, the respondents would still be able to throw up objections that because we had not managed to stop them from pleading guilty, because our convening authority had to, under the terms of this agreement, enter a sentence, the convening authority has to take the action after the jury decides the sentence, that we would be barred thereafter. And again, the standard under mandamus is not any potential or hypothetical or speculative avenue for relief. It has to be an adequate avenue for relief. And if nothing else, I think at the ballpark on how long it will take to go through the sentencing proceedings under these agreements to get to a place where we have waiver, where we can try this untested method under 950D of attempting to appeal after a waiver, I think that the ballpark on that is about 3 years. We think the much more straightforward route is to stop the pleas from happening in the first place.
Can you identify any statutory authority or the best statutory authority for the argument that you would be precluded from trying these detainees at a later point? Is there something in a statute, one or more rule?
I think there are questions under 10 U.S.C. 949H, and I don't have any cases for you about them. I don't know that it's ever been litigated about the circumstances in which jeopardy attaches under the statute. I can't tell you exactly how that will shake out because we haven't tried it yet. I think, again, the point here is that there are
argument under 959H? I know you're talking about statutory, yeah. Jeopardy, but that doesn't attach until it's become final after review has been fully completed.
I think there are questions about how that applies, not when it's a finding after a trial by the military commission, but a guilty plea accepted by the judge. I don't want to disclaim there may be an argument that we could make that statutory jeopardy does not attach until the finality of review. And then the further sort of asterisk of could we get further review under 950G, the piling of asterisks upon asterisks here about this hypothetical route are what make this an inadequate alternative to the relief that we're seeking.
What case law can you point us to support why we should have these doubts? Is it the Patterson and the McIntosh cases? Is it some
the larger body of constitutional double jeopardy cases? And I would, and potentially, I don't see anything in these papers from the respondents saying that this route is definitely available. They say it may be available. They say, I think, likely available. And nothing in these papers suggests that they do
burden,
not.
Right?
Correct. But it is our burden to show that there is no adequate, not that there is no hypothetical or speculative or possible avenue for relief here. And so I think under cases like Al-Nashiri and In re Muhammad, the mere possibility that there could be back-end review. And again, there was no question. There were none of these asterisks about whether or not this court would have the authority to undo those convictions in full. There are those asterisks here.
If we were to write an opinion that were to say that we have construed these relevant statutes, 949H, 950G, and we conclude that there is an adequate alternative remedy because the government can seek review under that point, isn't that going to be binding precedent on that issue when it comes up later?
In this court, it may. Of course, that would not bind the Supreme Court. And under usual principles of constitutional avoidance, I think it would be somewhat extraordinary to reach out and decide the constitutional double jeopardy question in this case. We don't think anything about this case, and certainly not on the set of papers we have here, requires the court to decide whether or not the double jeopardy clause applies.
We have to decide whether we have jurisdiction, and that's our first obligation. So I don't see how constitutional avoidance can, if this is central to whether we have jurisdiction or not,
I don't think
how constitutional avoidance does any work.
I apologize, Your Honor. I don't think there's any question about this court's jurisdiction, which is under 28 U.S.C. 1651, to issue a writ of mandamus. All that's necessary to trigger that authority, that jurisdiction, is the pendency of a proceeding that could lead to this court's jurisdiction. So I think the question is whether or not a one of jurisdiction, but whether or not as a substantive matter, we have shown that the roots.
So you don't think in this context, the three elements of mandamus are jurisdictional the way that they are in every other mandamus case? Is that your argument?
I think that they go to the, I think there, it is undoubted that this court has the authority to issue a writ in this proceeding. The question of whether or not the United States has met the substantive standards that make issuance of the writ appropriate, I don't think undermines this court's sort of backdrop authority, backdrop jurisdiction to issue it. So I don't think this court has to decide the constitutional asterisks, as I've been calling them, on the hypothetical route to relief that two, but not three, of respondents have sketched out as possible or likely in their papers. And I do, but I know I'm running short on time.
Anderson, can I, I'd like to ask you about some of the equities here. Even if we assume that the military, just assuming for a moment that the military judge erred on both legal grounds. So Secretary Austin here could have conditioned the convening authority's ability to enter into a plea that took the death penalty off the table from the beginning, right, as part of the delegation.
Yes, I think he absolutely could have placed limits on
he
the-
He could have placed limits.
Yes.
And at any point before the plea agreements were signed, he could have assumed the convening authority for himself.
Yes.
And so what is the, so, I mean, mandamus is an extraordinary remedy. Here, the executive branch could have controlled the convening authority, could have supervised the convening authority, could have previously stepped into the shoes of the convening authority. And having not done any of that for several years while these negotiations were going on, you know, these agreements were entered into. And now the government seeks from us the extraordinary writ. So explain why the writ is appropriate in these circumstances, where you have a dispute like this, where the executive had every opportunity and every power to control the exercise of the convening authority before the agreements were entered into.
I think the very arguments that respondents are raising here and the traction they got before the military judge about unlawful influence show why a prudent secretary might have wanted to let this process play out independently. Allowing the convening authority full and sole discretion to see where these plea negotiations landed. Of course, nobody knew if they were going to land anywhere.
The administration and the secretary were never going to want a plea agreement that took the death penalty off the table. That could have been made clear at the outset or at any point in the process.
I don't know if we know that that is that sort of top line, a deal taking the death penalty off the table is the reason the secretary withdrew. I think that when presented with these particular agreements, with these particular terms, the secretary saw them and decided that these were not an appropriate resolution of these prosecutions of national significance. I don't know.
The secretary just said, don't sign until I've looked at it. That wouldn't be unlawful influence. That would be, I'm reserving the ultimate decision as a superior convening authority to make the final decision on plea agreements, at least as to persons X, Y, and Z.
I agree with you, Your Honor, that that would not be unlawful influence, but it is far from clear that the military judge in this case would agree with that. And I think that at minimum,
That's kind of beside the point. The point here is whether the executive branch, as Judge Rao has said, could have fixed this itself quite easily. And this wasn't a surprise. They didn't see this coming or know what was going on or know with whom plea negotiations were underway. And then to say, I'm not going to do anything until it's all over, and then I might pull the rug out from under everything and then put all these courts in knots trying to figure out what to do next. This is an executive branch control within the executive branch problem. I don't know why it's a judicial branch problem.
Your Honor, there would have been knots had the secretary used his authority on the front end, just in terms of the arguments and potential invalidation of the sentences and the convictions that we're seeking.
It would be argument. I mean, they make arguments all the time, right? Unlawful influence goes to judicial authority by the convening authority, not prosecutorial authority by the convening authority. And so,
Your Honor,
the fact that someone's going to argue something doesn't mean that the executive branch shouldn't do its own job.
Your Honor, I disagree with the idea that a reasonable secretary could not think, let's see where this process goes. It's an independent process. Do I have the actual raw authority to pull it back? Yes. Will that create potential years of litigation over undue influence, which is a very capacious doctrine as it's understood in the military justice system? Also, yes. When the secretary was presented with the actual terms that had been reached, he acted promptly within 2 days.
Secretary had another option, which would have been that because this is so sensitive, this is so important, I alone will take over this negotiation. And because I think the premise of your papers is that some of the power can be within the secretary and some of it can be within the convening authority, right?
Correct.
So the secretary could have very easily dealt with this if this was going to be potentially sensitive and just said, I'm undelegating the power to you, convening authority, with respect to any potential pretrial agreements with these three detainees. And then there wouldn't be any problem at all, right?
I think the problems would have been the years of litigation over whether or not that was interfering unlawfully with a convening authority. The very arguments.
Getting that either way. They're arguing it now too.
But when the secretary was allowing his subordinate convening authority to see where these negotiations went, he did not know that we would get this any other way. He did not know that there would necessarily be agreements, and he certainly did not know what the specific terms of the agreements would be.
Anyone thinks it would be unlawful intervention at the outset to say, as to persons X, Y, and Z, you have all the authority to plead, but here's the bottom line.
I think there are many people, and I would ask the question to my friends on the other side, who think precisely that thinks that is unlawful and that would taint any convictions here. Again, this is music to my ears in terms of what counts as unlawful influence and not, but that is not how the military justice system invariably applies these principles.
I mean, the government's argument for why the secretary could withdraw the convening authorities delegation is that the secretary is ultimately responsible for this under the Military Commissions Act, which of course the secretary is, that he has ultimate responsibility and supervision and control and therefore could withdraw the authority. So if that's true, then I think the government has to have some account of the equities, you know, how that responsibility and control was exercised in this case. So if we viewed what happened here as the executive sleeping on its responsibilities, what is the best equitable argument for granting the writ here?
With a very significant caveat that I disagree with the characterization of sleeping on the equities or that it was unreasonable for the secretary to proceed as he did. Putting that aside, I think...
Well, it might be reasonable, but, you know, he had the power to do other, take other actions earlier in the process, as you have, you agree.
I agree, but I don't think the fact that he didn't use his power earlier means that it was unlawful for him to do it when he did, nor that the equities don't support effectuating his determination. When he got these plea agreements, when he saw them, he decided these agreements were not the best resolution of these cases, and he used his authority to countermand his subordinate's decision.
Okay, but so even assuming that the withdrawal of the convening authority was lawful, and that's a legal error by the military judge, I'm asking you for the best equitable case for why the writ should issue, because even when there's an error, this court still has to determine that the writ is appropriate.
Correct. And again,
I'm not hearing the best argument for that.
I think the sort of brass tacks argument about making sure that a secretary's determination and not his subordinate's determination is the one that controls. But let's assume that you agree with me on the legal point that the secretary's window to withdraw had not closed, that the secretary had the authority. At that point, what you are saying is even though the Secretary of Defense's determination about a matter of national significance has been countermanded by an unlawful application of Rule 705 D4B of the Rules for Military Commission, I think it's appropriate to leave that incorrect decisions on the book rather than issuing the writ to effectuate the Secretary of Defense's determination on this momentous matter. I know that the standard is high. I know that this court has a lot of discretion about the appropriate circumstances. This is the case in which to do it. If you agree with us on the legal principles about the 705 D4B argument, if you agree, as there seems to be consensus this morning, that there was no legal problem with pulling back the convening authority as to these pretrial agreements.
To be clear, we're just asking questions, so don't assume anything.
I apologize, Your Honor, but assuming some of the premises underlying the questions we've heard this morning, if those things were true on the equitable factor that Judge Rao is asking about, yes, this is the case to issue the writ. I know that I'm short on time.
I've got plenty of time.
Okay. Fair enough, Your Honor. There is one important matter that I want to make sure I say before I sit down, and it relates to an order that was issued by the Military Commission minutes before we came into court. That is the Military Commission has ordered the parties to be available as of 9 a.m. Thursday, this Thursday, January 30th, so that if this court denies mandamus relief, he can go ahead and start taking the pleas. For all the reasons we've discussed this morning, we are concerned that that will be an irremediable event. And so in the event that this court denies, the judge has made clear he's going to abide by this court's administrative stay. But if this court, for any reason, were to deny relief, we would respectfully request that this court leave in place the administrative stay it's issued for a modest period that would allow the United States and a small window to evaluate whether or not to seek further review. I think something like 10 days would be appropriate. But what we are worried about is that the Military Commission is poised to spring into action. It could be the second that this court denies relief, and we would like a little space to decide whether or not to seek further review.
Ms. Patterson, so on the two legal conclusions here, one, whether the secretary had authority to withdraw the delegation of convening authority. And then there's this question of whether the respondents had begun performance under the pretrial agreements. If we were to conclude that we agree with the government on the secretary's authority, right, that the secretary had authority to undertake the withdrawal, but we disagreed about the beginning of performance, is there any mandamus relief that would be appropriate? because they were alternative grounds by the military judge.
I think we have to win on both of those grounds, Your Honor, in order to meet the clear and indisputable right to relief. Now, we think we're right on both of those grounds.
But if we were to just agree on one.
I hate to bet against myself, Your Honor, but I think we have to win both here.
Sorry, before we go much deeper to that, I just have a few follow-up questions on where we've been in this. First of all, just somewhere back where we started a little bit ago, so there's no cases you're aware of where the government withdrew from a plea arrangement post-plea.
And we're not stopped by double jeopardy?
And was able to retry. So, yes, however you want to phrase it. They couldn't retry.
I think we were told we couldn't retry. I think it's the McIntosh case where there had been a plea entered, and then the government said, wait a minute, there was a problem with the indictment here, and we want to retry under a correct indictment. And we were told no, because jeopardy attaches. That's what we're concerned about. I think the cases are there. There are many other cases. I think this is an accepted precept that in many circumstances, once jeopardy attached because of the entry of a guilty plea, the government's hands are tied. That's the purpose of the double jeopardy clause.
There was sort of, you know, government's problem that led to the effort to withdraw. And that's where I'm trying to understand if the government. I know we're building a lot of things that all depend on each other, but if there was no error in the secretary overruling this decision, so there was, withdrawing from the plea agreements. And the unusual thing here would be at the time of the entry of the plea, the government would still be not on board with it. So it would be different than the McIntosh scenario. And if we find there was no flaw in the government process going up to that, would that case have any applicability? I mean, that seemed to be sort of a different issue there.
I'm unaware of there being any such case. We can take a look and try to find one. But I want to point out that that case might not exist because it's very odd to hold the government to a plea agreement before the pleas have ever been entered. There are often fights after a plea has been entered. Of course, the central promise in a plea agreement is to plead guilty. And so I am unaware of any cases. They may be out there and I just don't know about them, where the government has realized that it should not and does not want to go forward on a plea agreement before the guilty plea and tries to pull back and is nonetheless made to go forward with it. And then we have a case about the double jeopardy consequences of that. I don't know that that case exists, but I think, again, if what we're where this fits into the analysis is the adequacy of alternative avenues to relief.
But I think that where I think your argument seems to, in my mind, lose its force is that in McIntosh, the whole point was that the conviction was not vacated. There were not grounds present for the government to be able to prevail on a motion to withdraw. The government instead said, well, we think that there was a defect in the indictment, but the court said that wasn't grounds to vacate the conviction. So, I mean, standard double jeopardy law is that if the conviction is vacated, unless it's for sufficiency of the evidence, you can retry a defendant. That's the basic principle in civilian criminal cases. Would you not agree?
I am not sure that I agree with all of that. I don't necessarily
want
to
disagree.
Do you agree
with the last part? In the general rule is that double jeopardy does not bar retrial for a conviction that was vacated unless it was vacated due to insufficiency of the evidence.
I'm going to be candid with the court that I do not know all of the specifics in which we can overcome a claim of double jeopardy after a conviction. What we have here are respondents who are not forswearing bringing that type of challenge. We are sufficiently concerned, and we think the court should be sufficiently concerned, that either constitutional double jeopardy would bind the court's hands or that there would be such claims of prejudice, even sort of apart from the strict constitutional regime, which may or may not apply to these respondents, that they could not be fairly tried again after their guilty pleas. We think that makes the avenue of relief that they have hypothesized inadequate. And I just want to note, and this may...
If they were to agree and waive, you know, any potential double jeopardy claim, not even agree whether there is or not, they would agree to agree that it would be waived, then the path would be clear. Is that correct for the government to have an adequate alternative avenue for relief?
Not necessarily. I would defer to my friends on the other side about whether or not it would be effective assistance of counsel to forswear from the lectern today a constitutional challenge that has not been briefed or fully briefed or argued in this case. I do want to note that even if you thought,
I'm not asking you to speak for them. To be crystal clear, I trust they will be able to speak for themselves just fine. I'm just mentally trying to figure out what is, because a lot of things have been discussed here. Is that double jeopardy, constitutional double jeopardy prospect, the central bar to an adequate alternative avenue for relief?
It is one of the bars. It is not the only bar. It is the non-constitutional claims of prejudice that they would be able to launch at any attempt to retry them after their guilty pleas. It is the entire uncertainty that we could ever get to a court here after waiver. And it is, in terms of the adequacy, I just want to note that the timeline here, and I don't mean to stray into the equities, but I think they're relevant to the adequacy of the avenue of relief. The scenario we're talking about here is we go back, we are forced under duress to proceed through these pretrial agreements through years of sentencing proceedings, and then get back to this court and have us unwind it. And I know we're many years into this process, unwind it to the point we are right now. We do not think that that is an adequate alternative avenue for relief for what we're seeking here. I'm happy to... Your Honor, go ahead.
If you wanted to finish a sentence.
I didn't. I was going to ask if there were other areas that the court wanted.
I assume there are, and they're just being patient with me while I still try to wrap up these initial... Believe it or not, these are the threshold questions.
Fair.
On this improper influence thing, just explain to me how it would be any different in having to litigate issues of improper influence if the secretary did what happened here, where these arguments are being made of improper influence, versus a secretary up front saying, convening authority, you're assigned, you have all this discretion, you have all this authority, one limit, you may not forego the death penalty, may not agree not to pursue the death penalty for persons A, B, C, however long the list needs to be. What is the difference that you see between the improper influence? This is upfront and authorized by the convening authority.
Because in the latter scenario, the secretary would not have known that it would ever come to this pass, that these negotiations would ever go forward, that there would ever be plea agreements, and that the specific terms of the plea agreements would be something he was not willing to have go out under his authority.
Okay, so is there something else about this plea that made it untenable? It's either the death penalty, or it's the, I don't want to plea with them at all. It's got to be something that up front, the secretary, I assume it was missing a comma somewhere, right? There was something very big about this that caused this, you know, last hour change. I assume it was something substantial that could have been foreseen result of plea negotiations. Or it could have been, tell me why it's improper influence to say, I am the ultimate convening authority when it comes to signing off on pleas for persons X, Y, and Z, full stop. With that, you've said that's lawful for the secretary to do, that's fully within the secretary's lawful authority. They may argue on improper influence, but you've got that going either way. I'm not understanding why these arguments about he was so worried about improper influence allegations have any purchase on, because you're going to get it on either side.
Your Honor, I agree there's no unlawful influence here with the secretary pulling back the convening authority with the way he did. The other side emphatically disagrees. The military judge disagrees.
I understand that. That's why your whole argument that he didn't want to do anything up front because there'd be arguments about unlawful intervention don't make any sense to me, because I would have thought up front being straightforward, candid, here are the limits of the authority, now go do what you can, if anything, would have been clearer to everybody and not, you know, much less likely to be fall with any unlawful influence because it was an upfront term of negotiations that the secretary was well within his, would have been well within his discretion to impose.
Your Honor, the arguments we're facing here that this was unlawful as both a statutory matter and as of military justice principles are not simply the temporal aspects. It is that the secretary is simply barred from pulling back any part of the convening authority that he has handed over.
That's my question. And right. So why not just
because
not it, hand it over in the first place?
The,
limited in one little respect. I have to sign off.
Because then we would have been certain to face these types of arguments that, again, are gaining purchase before the military commission instead of it just being a possibility. And you asked about the terms of these agreements. I do not want to get into some of the specifics that are still under seal by virtue of the military commission's order. But this is not, it isn't, these are not one line agreements. And, you know, the sentence ranges that remain under seal, I think, are not sort of a foregone conclusion going in that the secretary would have thought, of course, these will be the words on the page. Now, to be clear, I have no personal knowledge about the secretary's personal knowledge. What we have in the record here is JA 14 through 23. I think it's the transcript of a press conference shortly after the secretary withdrew. At that point, I think the press secretary indicated that the secretary was surprised by these agreements, did not know if they ever would be issued, did not know what the terms would be. So that's what's in the record about here and explains that the press secretary said he was attempting to allow that process to be independent. And I think that the fights we have here and our losses before the military judge show why until you knew that there was going to be an agreement you would find unacceptable, you as a secretary might think, I will let this process play out and see where we land without courting a substantial chunk of all of the arguments, all of the protests, all of the possibilities that the judge will rule against us and find that we have in some way, no matter how in good faith we have proceeded, tainted these proceedings that have been ongoing since 2012.
Seems like that's really rolling the dice because I think you concede that if the detainees begin performance on the agreement after it's signed by the convening authority, then the secretary loses his power to withdraw. Do you agree with that?
I agree that if one of the respondents has begun performance of a promise contained in the agreement, the secretary would lose the window. But I also note that that rule contemplates that there is going to be a window. I don't know that the secretary would have thought maybe they will plead guilty in these next 2 days. Maybe they will begin performance of some other promise within the next 2 days. I think if you just read the text of 705D4B, if somebody had advised the secretary, can you still withdraw? If an agreement comes out that you disagreement, can you withdraw? You look at this rule and you would think, yes, there is a window.
Tell me. What in the rule says that there is a window after the convening authority countersigns the agreement?
This is in 705D4B. D4 controls withdrawal. D4A is by the accused. It sets out the time frame in which the accused can withdraw, and it is generous. It is any time. D4B sets out by the convening authority when the convening authority can withdraw. It is much less generous. He can withdraw at any time from a pretrial agreement at any time. That's the first part. And then we come to the strictures. The first one and relevant one here being before the accused begins performance of promises contained in the agreement.
So let's suppose in this case, the detainees sign, trial counsel, convening authority signs, and then 5 minutes after that, all respondents file motions to withdraw or notices that they're withdrawing all of their motions. Would you agree that if those were the facts, the secretary would not have the authority to withdraw?
Yes, if the agreement had said, upon signing by the convening authority, I promise to withdraw my motions, then yes, I think that would count as performance of a promise contained in the agreement. I'm adding the small caveat there because I think the wording in the relevant paragraphs here is a little different. I think it says, upon acceptance of the guilty plea by the military judge, I will withdraw. So there just might be a question
that's
there.
That's another question that I have, is that waiver language is different in all three of these agreements. It's not the same. You don't appear to contend in your briefs that those differences are material, that we should look at Muhammad's different than Benatash or al-Hassawi's. You just kind of treat them all as if there's no real material differences in them. Am I correct about that? That's your position?
That's correct, because the promise is to withdraw motions, and there's no contention here that anyone withdrew a motion within the 2 days. The contention and the reason the military judge found this relevant was because they refrained from questioning a witness on August 1st.
Okay, I understand that, but I'm getting to the premise of this whole equities thing and this whole issue about why it was prudent for the secretary to wait and see how this plays out, because that's taking a big gamble, because once, before the ink is even dry on the signature of the convening authority, these detainees could all take some action that would be explicit and certainly beginning performance, and then the secretary's hands would be tied. And that doesn't seem to me to be the way to run the railroad.
Your Honor, I think you're right that there may have been a way that these respondents could have began performing. And I think you're right that means that the window that 705D4B contemplates would close. What we're here today to say is that did not happen. These respondents did not do anything.
Well, my point is that I think it just kind of undermines the force and plausibility of your argument about, well, the secretary was being prudent by waiting. I don't see how it would be prudent at all, because events outside the secretary's control could happen that would completely take away his authority to withdraw and to undo this. So that's why I'm having trouble with your argument. Am I making myself clear?
I think so. And I think I'm going to return to the answer I gave Judge Rao earlier, which is, even if this is not the way that you, as the Secretary of Defense, with your manifold responsibilities, would have made this particular decision in this case, if you would have said, I'm going to run the risk of these arguments of unlawful influence, and at the outset, I am saying I get to decide whether there are any plea deals here. Even if all of that is true, even if the secretary, with minute attention to 705D4B, thought, I might be running a risk here, but I'm willing to run it. I'm going to grant you all of that for purposes of the hypothetical. And I still think the writ should be issued, because I think that the Secretary of Defense should be the one to make this decision, unless there is a legal impediment to him doing so. The only legal impediment I think we're talking about in this exchange is 705D4B. And as a matter of the larger equities, we do not think that a clear and unequivocal exercise of the Secretary of Defense's judgment on this particular matter regarding the fate of the 9/11 prosecutions should be held up on a loosey-goosey interpretation of 705D4B, which is what we think happened here.
Ms. Patterson, can I ask you the question about whether they began performance of a promise in the agreement? Is that a factual question or a legal question or a mixed question of law and fact?
I, I think it's a legal question. Both the interpretation of the pretrial agreements and the interpretation of Rule 705D4B.
So the interpretation, I agree, interpretation of an agreement or of a regulation is a legal question. But what about the facts of whether they have begun?
I think there's no question of sort of disputed question of historical facts. I think we can all see the transcripts and all see what happened here that the military judge pointed to as performance. There's no dispute about that. The question is, what is the meaning of 705D4B as it applies to these undisputed facts? And I think in the Dean case, the court very clearly said these are legal questions reviewed de novo.
So they're just purely legal questions.
I think that's right, Your Honor.
What about cases like U.S. v. Pollard and others that say that where basically whether a party has adhered to its promise, and that's really bound up in facts and course of dealing and what happened, that that's reviewed for clear error. And that's the way that the court reviewed that question in Pollard. And in general, you look at Hornbook contract law and contract cases, they say that the scope of a promise, where there could be some ambiguity about what the scope of the promise is in the contract and how it's worded, but that's a question of fact.
Your Honor, I'm not disputing that there can be factual disputes that underlying contract disputes. What I am saying here is that the fight between the parties, the basis on which the military judge ruled, is a dispute about the meaning of the terms, promises performed, whether or not they began performance of a promise contained in the agreement. So if you look at the USCMCR's analysis on this, we think there's just a clear and legally incorrect leap between saying things like they refrained from questioning a witness and therefore they began performance under paragraphs either 22 or 23. We think that's a legal error.
Well, because the military commission judge and the CMCR had to identify what was the promise. You can't answer the question of whether someone has begun performance on a promise until you know what the promise is. And so the question of what is the promise and was this encompassed within the promise is a question that they had to answer by looking at the agreement and the conduct of the parties, et cetera. And isn't that a factual question?
No, Your Honor. I think where the USCMCR legally erred and the same for the military judge is by failing to identify anything that qualifies as a promise within the legal meaning of the word promise in 705D4B. There are no sort of factual findings about who said what when in these cases.
I mean, the rule itself, all of the rules about pretrial agreements say that one of the promises that is allowed or permissible and that's part of a common pretrial agreement is entry into a stipulation of fact, right?
Yes, but these facts, these stipulations were executed before the agreement even existed.
Well, the agreement says that that is a promise to enter into them is one of the promises that these detainees are making. And if they breach that promise by refusing to enter into them, then they will be in breach of the agreement, right?
Your Honor, I think we're talking about paragraph 6 that says language, I agree to enter into these stipulations. I think we also have to look at the final two paragraphs of the agreements and the actual attachments to the agreements that make clear that what was being part of the offer and what preceded and then became part of the agreement itself was an executed stipulation.
You're saying we have to look at the attachments to the agreements. You mean the stipulations themselves?
Yes, which I do not believe are currently in the record.
Well, that was going to be my question. If you're arguing that we have to base our argument on that and you didn't put it in the record, what are we supposed to do with that?
Your Honor, it is uncontested that these stipulations were executed beforehand. If this court would like to see the stipulations, we're happy to submit them. They are under seal. And so, but we can file sealed copies with the court. But again, it's not disputed between the parties.
Did the government also have to execute the stipulations?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that these were their stipulations that they signed attached to their offer.
I want you to get the answer to that question, not what
I will. Whether or not, I mean, so whether or not
there are cases like, you know, USV, I think it's Forrester or Pruner and Forrester, some military commission cases where they talk about stipulations of fact and that they are signed by both the accused and the government. And usually a stipulation is signed by both parties. That's what kind of it means that the parties stipulate. So, you know, something could be an admission where one party signs it, but usually a stipulation is signed by both parties.
I will certainly submit those under seal to the court. I'm not sure it has any legal relevance here because whether one or both parties signed them, these were actions done before the agreement existed. It is clear that this agreement.
Well, when did the agreement begin to exist?
On July 31st.
When the detainee signed or when the government signed and the convening, I guess, the trial counsel and then the convening authority had signed last, right?
Emphatically, the latter, Your Honor. It was not an agreement until the convening authority signed. The convening authority is the only one with the authority to enter into a pretrial agreement.
Okay, so my point is that your argument is that there is no agreement that takes effect until the convening authority signed. Well, if the convening authority also had to sign the stipulation for it to have any effect, then why isn't the right way to look at this that basically they began performance of the agreement commensurate with the entry of the agreement?
Your Honor, paragraph 62 explains that the convening authority's acceptance of this offer, including attachments A through C, and remember, attachment A is the already signed stipulation, will transform this offer into an agreement binding upon him and the government. I've been informed by my colleagues that the stipulations of fact were signed by the accused counsel, and the trial counsel, not by the convening authority. And if you would like, I can still certainly file those under seal in this court.
Please do.
But I think that our point here is that these acts, these signing of these stipulations came before the agreement even existed. The agreement did not exist until July 31st when the convening authority signed. And we do not think that doing something before the agreement existed counts as beginning performance of a promise contained in the agreement. We think that is a straightforward misreading.
Right. They begin performance on July 31st once it was signed, the agreement was signed by the convening authority?
No, Your Honor. I don't think there were any forward-looking promises regarding the stipulations that they were performing.
At the moment the convening authority assigns, it becomes an agreement, and that signing becomes a performance.
I don't think it becomes the respondent's performance, Your Honor. There's no forward-looking promise in here about doing anything else with the stipulations they had already entered into. Now, of course, they have promised to do other things in the future, like plead guilty on the basis of those stipulations, or when the government tries to introduce evidence based on those stipulations.
I have a problem with this because I see other cases like this Forrester case, U.S. v. Forrester at 48 MJ1, and U.S. v. Pruner at 37 MJ 573. But in Pruner, what happens is that there's an agreement that the accused will enter into a stipulation of fact, but they hadn't hashed out all the details of that stipulation prior to signing the agreement. And essentially, it appears that those kind of negotiations broke down and the parties couldn't agree on the language and wording of that stipulation. And then the government sought to withdraw and they were allowed to withdraw. The point being is that the stipulation of fact, you could either hash out all of the wording and every comma and et cetera beforehand, or you can leave it until afterwards, but then it raises a significant question that if you can't agree to any of that, to all of that, then the whole thing is for naught. And here it appears, and there's email correspondence, et cetera, that's in the record, I think the JA-458, there's some email correspondence where the government says, you know, at a minimum, the stipulations of fact, they're going to need to include A, B, and C, and that sort of thing. But it appears that this is an incident where, incidents where both parties, for whatever reason, thought that it was in their best interest to hash out all of the terms of the stipulation of fact ahead of time, and they attached it to the agreement as an exhibit so that there'd be no question. And then it's signed by the accused and the trial counsel at the time that the agreement is entered, so that, you know, that's out of the way. When they did all of that to preclude there from being any issues in the future, why wouldn't it be appropriate to consider that to be beginning performance?
Because we're not talking about beginning performance on the contract generally or anything implied in the contract. The language of 705D4B is quite specific that it has to be beginning performance of a promise contained in the agreement.
Well, a promise in the agreement is to enter into a stipulation.
But they had already done that, Your Honor. The agreement was not yet formed.
The language of the rule doesn't say begin performance of promises, you know, pursuant or I don't know, some other verb. It just says contained in the agreement. So if we're just going to follow the rule, if we say that contained within the agreement are the words that the accused will enter into a stipulation, then they've done that, right?
Your Honor, I think that what we have to look for is a promise contained in the agreement. And we think promise is a promise to do something in the future as a matter of basic contract law. I want to point out that this idea that your performance can begin the second the agreement forms really would render nugatory Rule 705D4B's primary purpose of giving the convening authority a window to withdraw. And I want to note, moreover, the purpose of this rule, I think.
Is that the purpose? The rule is written to protect the convening authority by giving them the window?
I think that's part of it, Your Honor. And of course, performance can
agree them. The window could be a nanosecond.
We agree that if respondents take actions, it's not much protection, but that doesn't mean it's non-existent. But I think one of the larger purposes.
If it's one that can't be acted upon, that's the same as non-existent. You know, if they had 1 second later said they had somebody on the phone and they said file. I don't know how you can read the statute as protecting a right that can there's no reason whatsoever it can ever be exercised.
Your Honor, there may be ways that respondents could behave to shorten our window.
And we don't write statutes.
But I think one of
protect rights, we write them to protect rights.
I think one of the other purposes that this rule is designed to protect is the idea that even if you undo an agreement, there may be circumstances where performance on a promise contained, actions taken after the agreement, can't be undone just because you've undone the agreement. So if the agreement says something like, you signed the agreement convening authority, and then I will disclose to the authorities where the bodies are buried. If we end, he is only willing to disclose once we've signed. If an accused performs on that promise, even if the agreement, we want to withdraw from the agreement and undo the agreement, we may not be able to undo all of the promise performance that happens. Now, I think the fact that the things that respondents are pointing to here as performance, they cannot point to any prejudice that they will suffer, reflects the fact there is not. And I'm not saying there is. I am saying that it helps illustrate why nothing that happened counts as performance, that there is none of the kind of prejudice that I think the rule is designed to help protect. It may have a prophylactic aspect.
Any case that says performance depends upon the existence of prejudice?
No, Your Honor.
Prejudicial performance?
And I'm not trying to read in a reliance aspect. I'm trying to appeal to the purposes of this rule is, I think, twofold.
Not the text of the rule, just...
Well, if we're talking...
The purposes of the rule.
Isn't the text of the rule more in your favor than this non-existent prejudice argument?
Indeed, Your Honor. I was going to say that if what we are talking about is the text of the rule, I don't think they can point to any promise contained in this agreement that they began performance of. And I don't think the military judge either can do that. They point to what they consider promises that antedate the agreement. They point to things that happened after the agreement but bear no relationship to the actual text of the agreement or a promise therein. And that's why we think that under the plain text of this rule, the military judge erred.
Well, the military judge and trial counsel thought that the text of the agreement precluded them from participating in this hearing on this motion to suppress. They didn't pull that out of thin air. They pulled that out of the text of the agreement and the way that guilty pleas work. I mean, the Supreme Court has said that, you know, the effect of a guilty plea is that you waive any further right to kind of do factual development or have any sort of evidentiary hearing on a claim, even a claim that if the claim itself isn't waived, like a double jeopardy claim, your guilty plea precludes you from having an evidentiary hearing in support of your double jeopardy claim. That's just what guilty pleas do. So the military commission judge, like the trial counsel, read the waiver language as precluding them from, you know, contesting at all anything, any facts in the stipulation or participating any further in this sort of litigation. And so that gets back to this whole question of, well, what was the scope of the promises? And the military commission judge, upheld by the CMCR, ruled that that was within the scope of the promises. So why was that clear error?
Your Honor, I think there is a difference between conditions in a contract and whether or not you have breached them, and whether or not you can point to a promise to do something in the future, and whether or not you have begun to fulfill that promise. I take it that we're talking about the exchange, and I think that JA 143 through 146 of the joint appendix. I think it's clear that our prosecutors thought that, and this was, I think, a very sensible thing, that it did not make sense to have respondents continue questioning a witness where that would only be in furtherance of motions that they had at that point, we were all in agreement, they would not be filing in the future. I don't think that suggestion means that we somehow agreed you are performing a promise by not questioning this witness. And of course, nothing in the language of paragraphs either 22 or 23 says anything about sort of refraining from taking preparatory steps that might in the future aid you in filing the motions that you agree in the future to waive. It only talks about in the future, not making these motions, about refraining from making these motions. What happened at that hearing, and the judge was very clear that it could be undone. On JA 146, the judge says, okay, makes sense to have the respondents who've taken the pretrial agreements simply observe, not participate. But if for some reason this deal goes sideways, and of course we weren't anywhere near actual guilty pleas, which I think was the jumping off point for your question. This is 146. I'm going to give that team a chance to question the witness on that day, if they can demonstrate that they actually have any additional matters to present. If for some reason I'm not able to accept a guilty plea from one of the accused. So I think just both as a matter of the text of the agreement, we don't have a promise. We don't have, as a matter of the text of performance, we don't have performance on anything that's in the agreement. So no matter how sensible that way of proceeding at that time was, it does not mean that they began to perform on a promise contained in this agreement.
So if I need my picket fence painted at my home, and I talk to a painter and I say, I'd like for you to do it. And the painter says, okay, you know, I'll see when my schedule is available. And, but we don't have any further conversation. And the painter, you know, has some jobs that fall through. So he starts painting my fence and gets halfway done. And I come home and we then agree about the price, and I'm going to pay him $1,000 to paint the fence. And we sign the agreement at that point. At that moment, has the painter begun performing the promises in the contract?
No, because the contract had not existed until you signed it.
What do we call the work that he did up to that point if it's not performing a promise in the beginning, performing a promise in the contract?
I suppose you could call it performance and anticipation of a contract. I suppose you could call it pre-contract performance. I think you could call it a lot of things, but what I don't think you can call it is performance and a promise contained in an agreement that did not yet exist.
So contained in the agreement. Well, the agreement says paint the fence and I'll give you $1,000. So you're saying that should be read, or that should be understood, that the 50% of the fence that was painted is not really contained in the agreement?
I think he hadn't begun performance. Maybe there's a promise to paint or finish painting the fence contained in the agreement. I don't think he had begun performance on the promise contained in the agreement, because the agreement did not, everyone could walk away in your hypothetical with your fence half painted. So I think what we're looking for under D4B is beginning performance of a promise contained in the agreement.
And that happens simultaneously with the formation of the agreement. Is your position, is the government's position, that contracts cannot be performed simultaneous with the agreement itself?
I think you could probably structure a contract that way.
Outside Taylor Swift concert with a child who desperately wants to go in, looking for someone to sell the tickets. I walk up and I say, you have a Taylor Swift concert ticket. I'll give you $500 for it. And they go, yeah, I have one here. And we just exchange at that moment. All right. The agreement and the exchange happen at the same time. That's a valid contract. Yes.
I think so, Your Honor.
Offer acceptance consideration. They all happened simultaneously. Did that person perform them under the contract? Absolutely. You could promise to give me this in exchange for this. It's just, we handed it simultaneously. This is a case about simultaneity. This is a case in which the stipulations of the, one of the arguments that the stipulation of fact was simultaneously entered into with the formation of the agreement. If that is a basic contract principle that they can, performance and agreement can happen at the same moment, which you said is true, and I think has to be true, why isn't that what happened here?
I think because in your Taylor Swift example, we don't have a rule that contemplates a forward-looking action in the contract you've posited with the ticket scalper.
The contract is filled with promises. Where does it say forward as opposed to simultaneous fulfillment of that promise?
I think that's the basic definition of a promise as set out in this court's decision in Choate, as set out in the restatement, is that you can certainly do things that precede the formation of a contract. There can be performances.
No, they can be simultaneous. It's not, I'm not talking about pre-agreement performance. I am talking about the second the convening authority's signature was inked on that piece of paper. As you pointed out, at that moment, according to the ending paragraphs of this agreement, it sprung into a fulfilled obligation. It was no obligation until the convening authority signed. And at that point, it was, and it was locked in, locked down. If we understand contract law that way, how is this not performance of a promise within the agreement?
Because I think Rule 705D4B contemplates a forward-looking promise, some action after. Recall that this is a rule designed to govern when either side can withdraw from the contract. If we are taking that view of what it means to be...
If you wanted a window, we all have, you know, a 7-day trial period. You can write that into the contract. But there's nothing like that here. And I think the fact that there are conditions and terms for withdrawal on both sides show that it is not, there's no time window. There's no time limit on or time frame in which withdrawal is allowed if in fact performance happens simultaneous with the creation of the agreement. The secretary should have written a different agreement.
Your Honor, I think the secretary, or not the secretary, the convening authority accepted an agreement that had as a done deal stipulations attached to it as part of the agreement that was entered. Under Rule 7, however you can construct a contract hypothetical where promises, the only promise is immediately performed, as in your ticket exchange, that is not what 705D4B says. It contemplates that there will be a promise contained in the agreement and at some point after the agreement, and I'm not saying it's a defined time window, but there will be a window.
You don't like it simultaneous. Were they not continuing to perform, having that stipulation of facts the second after?
They were continuing
to perform it. They were continuing it. They weren't withdrawing it. They weren't saying never mind. They were continuing to adhere to their stipulation of facts that next moment and the next moment after that and every moment for the next 48 hours. They were adhering to, locked in, and agreeing to. They were engaged in the act of agreeing to that now binding stipulation of facts. They didn't withdraw. They didn't do anything. They continued to stick to their agreed upon stipulation of facts.
I think they were not breaching by not trying to disturb the stipulation they had already executed. I do not think that counts.
More than not breaching, they were continuing to stick with it. I just don't understand how it can be simultaneous performance and then it's kept in place. They could have, you said, they could have withdrawn. There's reasons they could have withdrawn and they didn't. They continued, that wouldn't be a breach. They continued to adhere to having a stipulation of fact.
Your Honor, the very next clause of 705D4B talks about another circumstance when the convening authority can withdraw, and that is upon the failure to fulfill a material condition or promise. I think this rule and the text of it contemplates that there is a difference between conditions and not breaching conditions, like having that executed stipulation of fact on file as an attachment to the agreement, and beginning to perform a promise, beginning to actually do acts under the agreement after the agreement has been executed.
Ms. Patterson, is there a difference between performance and performance of a promise in a contract?
I think there could be. I think sort of maybe in a looser sense, you're performing by not breaching, but I don't think that counts as performance of a promise contained in the agreement.
So let's suppose the agreement is signed by the convening authority, and 5 minutes later, the convening authority says, I am going to withdraw from this agreement because the accused have failed to fulfill a material promise in that they didn't file their motions to withdraw their guilty, their motions yet. Do you think that would be a reasonable way to construe the rule that they could, based on that argument, say that they've failed to fulfill this promise?
In your 5 minute hypothetical scenario, I think that the convening authority could withdraw for any reason because no performance would have begun. So I don't think you would need to look to that second clause in D4B.
Don't change the hypothetical. That's the argument that they make. Should we or the court accept that?
To make sure that, I understand.
That they failed to fulfill their promise to file a motion, the withdrawal of their motions.
I want to make sure I understand the hypothetical. It is.
And the detainees say, well, I mean, we didn't have any time yet. It's only been 5 minutes.
I think if there were there, so there's no question about the first clause about performing promise. And we're relying solely, just to make sure I understand the hypothetical, we're relying solely on failure to fulfill a material condition.
Yes.
I think at that point, the parties could dispute whether or not they'd had an opportunity and whether or not it was in fact a breach or a true failure to fulfill a condition for which there had been inadequate time to perform. So I think to the extent you're suggesting, we might have trouble invoking that second clause of D4B on this hypothetical. I think I agree.
My question to you is would the convening authority be within their rights to rely on this? And should, if that issue were before us today, should we say that, yes, the convening authority can withdraw because the accused failed to fulfill this material promise? It doesn't matter that they only have 5 minutes. They fail to fulfill it, and the rule is the rule.
I think we're in this hypothetical, there is no first clause where the convening authority can withdraw at any time before performance.
For whatever reason, the government isn't relying on that first clause. The government is relying on this clause. I'm trying to get you to tell me how we should construe that second clause.
I don't know in all of the particulars how that clause should be construed. It might well be that we cannot invoke it, that clause, to satisfy that hypothetical. I think our point about the second clause is that it contemplates that conditions and failing to fulfill them and promises can stand on different ground. And so we don't want the court to adopt a reading of the first clause about beginning performance of a promise contained in the agreement so capaciously that it essentially collapses into the second clause, or such that it essentially renders nugatory this window. And I know I'm going to make Judge Millett mad by referring to a window. I am not saying it is a fixed window, but I think this rule contemplates that there is some opportunity after the formation of the agreement for the convening authority to change
the this rule contemplate
until the beginning of performance, Your Honor.
So I just want to make sure I understand your position, that the rule locks in for the secretary something that could be less than a second. That's really an important thing.
Yes. And it's, if you are suggesting that the secretary.
The text, it's just that you're assuming that since there's a right to withdraw before performance, there must be some gap between signing and performance.
I'm saying that we should not adopt a reading of the rule that would make that window zero in almost every case. There will always be conditions and contracts.
But it won't be in every case. It's just in those cases where, for whatever reason, I mean, the government got the benefit of its bargain in the sense that it didn't want this case to be like others where, you know, we go through all of this and we can't agree on the stipulation later. The government apparently insisted on reaching an agreement about the contents of the stipulation and doing that contemporaneously. So, you know, the government chose to operate in that fashion. The government could have said, don't sign the stipulation yet. Or the government could have elected itself not to sign the stipulation to give it some time. But it, for whatever reason, in its wisdom, decided to do it all together.
I very much disagree that we have already gotten the benefit of the bargain we struck here. No one has pleaded guilty. And I want to point out that these stipulations will have no ongoing effect. We cannot use them for any purpose if we withdraw from this agreement.
Does that include impeachment?
Yes. It is under Rule for Military Commission 410, which, like its civilian analog, precludes, contemplates that there will be stipulations, there will be admissions, both in the plea negotiations leading up to a guilty plea and sometimes even after a guilty plea. If for any reason that guilty plea is allowed to be withdrawn, if those plea negotiations go sideways, the rule of evidence bars the government from using any statements or stipulations made for any purpose.
But information derived from those statements?
I don't know that it governs information derived from those statements, but recall they had offered us that information even before the agreement was struck. They did that knowing that the convening authority might never accept these agreements. And you asked about impeachment, Your Honor. There is an exception in the rule for statements made under oath and in the record. These stipulations were not made under oath. So there is no possibility that we could use them for any purpose in the future under 410.
And I just want to confirm one thing. So the government's official position on 750 is that they're simply with this right to withdraw window.
705, Your Honor?
Sorry.
Yes. Just want to make sure I have the rule right.
I apologize. Yeah. There's a lot of numbers in here. That there cannot then ever be a contract covered by that rule in which there is simultaneous agreement and performance.
I don't know that I would go that far, Your Honor.
You have gone that far. You said there has to be a window for withdrawal.
I think what I am saying is some of the readings that the respondents have put forward of this rule read promise beginning performance of a promise contained in the agreement so capaciously based
I'm
on.
I'm asking about, don't tell me about their readings. I want you to tell me about your reading, which is that 7054B has to leave some window, even if it's a fantastical one of a nanosecond.
Has to leave some window
for withdrawal.
A possible window for withdrawal, yes.
A possible window or yes. A window?
A possible window, Your Honor. We're not saying that there aren't ways that respondents can close this window. There aren't ways to construct a contract.
Can you have a contract in which performance occurs simultaneously with agreement, or the government's position is no, because under a simultaneous performance and agreement, there's no window for withdrawal by the government?
I think you could construct a contract that said the second after, I promise that in the second after the convening authority signs, I will not make any motions.
I'm not saying in the second after. I am saying at the same moment. It's recognized in contract law that you can have performance at the time of agreement. That is recognized everywhere else in the world. Okay, so I'm not giving you a second. I am telling you performance at the moment of agreement. And under that question, under that scenario, that's forbidden by Rule 705 because there's not a second. There's not a nanosecond. There's no time for withdrawal by the government. Yet, those contracts are just not allowed. That's the government's position.
Not exactly, Your Honor. Rule 705, subsection C, mm-hmm. governs what types of terms and conditions can be written into these contracts. Mm-hmm. I don't think there is anything forbidding a contract term that said something like, the convening authorities signing on this line will be construed as beginning of performing of a promise contained in this agreement. I think you could contract around D4B. I'm not sure it's forbidden by the rules. But what I am saying is you should not adopt a reading of the rule.
Well, then why? Okay, so then why wouldn't we? So if we read this contract and how it dealt with the stipulation of fact, something that was written and agreed upon before, and then you have a clause that says at the moment this is signed, this and by the way, this is a really important thing to perform is to have the stipulation of fact. It's really, really important. It's in here many references to it throughout the agreement. At that moment, it springs into an agreed upon stipulation of fact as to which they're obligated to enter. If we read it as having been written to accomplish simultaneous agreement and performance, then there's no 7054 problem.
I think that's right, Your Honor. I think our argument is very much that nothing in that these agreements do not contain a forward-looking promise and that nothing happened in these 2 days by the response that count as performance.
The moment it was signed.
All right, whether it's the moment signed or in the next 48 hours. Mm-hmm. I think our argument is not that you could not, and I think it would be through explicit language, contract around D4B, that is somehow forbidden by the rule. We are urging a rule that is not a construction of this rule that is not so capacious that it makes it essentially the default that by fulfilling the conditions or not breaching the conditions that went into the formation of the contract, you did things to induce us to enter into the agreement. If those count sort of on a very broad understanding of both what counts as performance and what counts as promise, we think you are more or less rendering 705 D4B nugatory.
We wouldn't be the contract would be. You just said it's fine for them to contract out of it. Don't put it on us.
But I think the question is whether or not we had to contract into it. And I think the answer here is...
You contracted into it.
I think we contracted against the backdrop of 705 D4B and the window. So I don't mean to beg the question.
I'm just telling you, if one were to read this, look at this contract language and say, as you pointed out, it says something magical happens at the moment it's signed ultimately by the convening authority. Stop at the convening authority.
I don't think
that's what happens in the agreement.
I think the magical thing that happened at that moment was that the agreement came into existence. I don't think
that
meant
the attachment.
But I think the
attachment included the attachment.
It does. But the agreements, the attachments predated the existence. Now, the agreement.
No, they were just an offer before that. But at the moment it was signed, they changed from an offer from the defendants to agreement. That's what changed. And that's what it says changed. Before that, just an offer.
It is an offer, but I think what we are doing in this hypothetical is reading in the language.
I'm talking about this contract right now.
Is reading into this contract, I will enter into stipulations. That's the language of this contract. They had already performed that promise beforehand.
They just entered into a proposed stipulation, because it didn't become a stipulation, as Judge Wilkins has said before, until the government agreed. Before that, it was just an offer of stipulation. But when the government signed off and said, yes, this agreement, that statement of facts attached to addendum A, we're on board with that too. It was no longer an offer. It was the stipulation of facts.
I think the stipulation was
a joint stipulation of facts.
The stipulation existed before and was signed by both sides before.
Before the military council signed it? Before the convening authority signed it?
As we have discussed earlier, as my colleagues informed me, it was signed by both sides before it was attached. It then became part of, it was a certainly revocable, and in ways that we could not use it if this did not result in a binding plea agreement, but it existed before the agreement ever did.
It existed as an offer. It did not exist as a contracted stipulation of fact. What they agree in this agreement is to enter into that contracted stipulation of fact, contracted one, mutually contracted. And it became a mutually contracted. It was not a mutually contracted statement of fact the second before the convening authority signed.
I think it was, Your Honor. I think it did not have the same force or it was not part of the same agreement before the convening authority signed.
Okay. Help me understand the chronology. as you understand it present. When was the stipulation of fact signed by the respondents?
I don't know.
All on the same day?
I don't know, Your Honor. I believe it was several days before the convening authority assigned. I know they signed their agreements on July 29th and 30th. I don't know what date the attached stipulations were signed. We can probably find out.
And what day did the either, you're saying trial counsel signed the stipulations?
Yes, and I don't know what day they signed. I don't know if it was the same.
And are you contending that trial counsel signed the stipulations prior to the time that either party signed the pretrial agreement?
I certainly, before the convening authority signed the pretrial agreement, I don't know about the chronology of dates of the trial counsel signing the stipulation and then the detainees signing the agreement offers. But we can find out. We will file them under seal in this court.
So what does paragraph 6 mean when it says the accused understands that a failure to enter into a stipulation of fact is a breach of a material term of this agreement? That sounds like a promise.
It does. I think you have to read it in light of the entire package here. And attachment A was not, I think if attachment A had been an unsigned stipulation, then you would read this language as a forward-looking promise to sign it. But that is not what attachment A was. Attachment A was an already signed stipulation. So given that the entirety of the contract, of the papers offered to the convening authority, was an executed stipulation, not an offer to execute a stipulation in the future, I do not think this constitutes a promise contained in the agreement.
Ms. Patterson, who drafted the pretrial agreements? Were they drafted by the respondents or by the government?
I don't know, Your Honor, and I don't know if it was a joint effort. I know that the parties had jointly discussed everything in these agreements over the course of a while, so it would not surprise me if both sides had input, but as a factual matter, I don't know.
I want to ask you a question, but I'm going to ask you carefully because it refers to a paragraph that's under seal. And so if you can't answer, then you can go in session at the end of this argument to get the answer. If you look at paragraph 60, does that have relevance to our discussion here? In which agreement? 60, and then we start with the Muhammad agreement.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
I don't think it has, and I'm going to answer carefully for the same reason. I don't think it has any relevance here because I don't think there's any contention that they did any of the acts referred to by verbs in this paragraph. I apologize for being so obtuse. No. I think we can answer, we can have a discussion without getting into the details. I don't think they did any of the things discussed in this paragraph. And I think
this was something that was to happen later.
That it would happen later and that had there's not even an allegation it happened. Of course, this is not something respondents point mm-hmm. to as a basis. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a reason why I think this had not happened yet.
So when I ask whether it has any relevance, I'm wondering if that has relevance to the language in paragraph 6.
The
or not.
I think if the to put it on par with paragraph 6, I think what we would have to have is an attachment that says we've already done these things.
I think our question is not being understood, so we may have to go into closed session briefly at the end of this argument.
Certainly. We're here at the court's.
Not communicating well with our court's direct language, and that's not your fault at all. And so now, back in the unsealed material, does the phrase enter into means have sort of specialized meaning under this contract that's different than proposing it and having it signed at the contract time?
I think we understand it as signing it. As
signing the stipulation.
Signing the stipulation, yes.
But you can't enter into a stipulation until it's signed by both parties. Just like you can't enter into a contract until it's signed by both parties.
I'm not sure. I'm not entirely sure that you couldn't have a one-sided stipulation. If one party just wants to say, I admit these things, I think that could be. If it's the party doing the admitting, I think that could be a one-sided thing.
But this was a stipulation that had signatories on both sides, and all the negotiating history that we have in there is that the government was going to allow the respondents to unilaterally say what they were stipulating to. The government had to agree.
I think that's right, Your Honor.
So how can one enter into a stipulation by just signing it? Because unless and until the other party signs it, they haven't entered into the stipulation yet, right?
I think you can have a unilateral stipulation. I think, you know, in government and even in civil litigation, we stipulate to things happening, saying we admit these things happened. Now, of course, we cannot hold.
Don't enter into. I'm asking about the phrase.
Enter into? And I think we could enter into a stipulation unilaterally. I don't think that that is language that could be used exclusively with a two-sided agreement. This was a two-sided agreement. Both sides signed it before it was presented to the convening authority.
Any more stipulating to be done once the ink was dried on this agreement?
I don't think so.
These facts?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think the condition in the contract was you don't pull back.
There must have been some forward-looking aspect to it, because there's language in here that says failure enter into it will be a material breach. And that doesn't make much sense if it was never a promise. It was something that was completed, as you would say, before, or as one might say, at the same time as the agreement was concluded. Why have language about a material breach if it wasn't going, if it came into existence upon the signing of the agreement? There's no window in which a material breach could occur.
And why have an attachment that already has a pre-executed...
I would like to answer my question before you ask me a question.
My answer is that you have to read that language against the contract as a whole. And the contract included a stipulation that had already been entered into.
I don't even understand that answer.
I think what that...
How could they have ever, given that this was going to be done and dusted at the time the convening authority signed, how could there ever then have been a material breach of the failure to, by a material breach by failing to enter into the stipulation of facts? How could that ever happen at a later stage?
I think if they had pulled back from the stipulation, that would be fairly described as failing to enter into or failing to abide by their entry into the stipulation of fact. I understand the court's concerns under paragraph 6.
Not withdrawing would be abiding by their entry into the stipulation of facts, and then trying to get out of it would be failing to abide by their entry of the stipulation of facts.
I think the stipulation of facts were a material condition that they abided by.
It's finished at the time the agreement was signed.
That this was not a promise to do something in the future, and that the language of paragraph 6 that we've been focusing on, agrees to enter into the stipulation of fact, has to be read against the contract as a whole.
Do you have to enter it again in front of the military judge or not? Are these proceedings not like civilian criminal courts where there's going to be eyeball with a judge allocution going over the facts, statements of facts, either it's read or recited? Do they not have to enter into a stipulation of facts again at that point?
Yes, is the short answer. There's a providence inquiry in front of the military judge who, much like a plea colloquy in a civilian court, has to.
So this was an ongoing obligation at the start, and then there were going to be other stages where it had to happen, at least one other stage where it had to happen again?
As construed thus, I think what that would mean is that...
Is that an accurate... I don't want to... I'm not... This is not a hypothetical question. Is that what this contract envisions?
I have understood, I think we have understood, the enter into the stipulation of facts to refer to a done deal, a done but revocable deal under Attachment A. I think you are correct that in the future, they were agreeing to not challenge any of these facts in the providence inquiry before the judge when they actually pleaded guilty, which is, of course, the central promise here. I don't think that they have breached. They did nothing to breach this paragraph 6 or any future obligations to plead guilty. My only point here is I don't think they began performance of a promise contained in the agreement by virtue of acts they completed before. And whether or not you see that as the absence of a forward-looking promise, or you see that as the absence of any performance, by which I mean actions taken after this contract was entered, I think we have not entered 705D4B territory here. And that the military judge's decision to not give effect to the secretary's withdrawal on this basis was wrong.
Does the convening authority not having signed the stipulation of fact have any relevance given paragraphs 62 and 63? Or in signing this agreement, do you necessarily sign on to the attachments, which is kind of how I read it?
I think we're in agreement, Your Honor. I think by signing the agreement, the convening authority was signing an agreement that include attachment A, which was the stipulation.
Effectively signing the, it was incorporated into a single unit, so effectively signed.
Yes, I think that's right.
The stipulation of fact as well.
I think that's right, Your Honor. I'm happy to answer any further questions. I see I am over time. I'm hoping for at least a few minutes of rebuttal.
We offered contracted for 20 minutes and you've gotten four multiples of it. whether you wanted it or not.
I appreciate the court's time. I do know that we are under a demanding standard and that we have made a big ask of this court. But we think if, you know, there have been, I think, something like 31 petitions for mandamus to this court from these military commissions, all by respondents. This is the first time the United States has sought one. We think this is the circumstance to issue the writ and effectuate and allow the Secretary of Defense's determinations to govern the course of the prosecutions of the alleged mastermind of 9/11 and two alleged co-conspirators.
Okay. And we will give you some time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Can we take a 5-minute break? Would everyone like that?
This honorable court is again in session. Be seated, please.
We'll hear now from counsel for the respondents, for respondents Mohammed and Al-Hassawi, and then for respondent Benatash.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you. I'm Michel Parody for respondents Mohammed and Hassawi. My colleague, Mr. Engel, will be making a few remarks on behalf of Mr. Benatash, specifically focusing on the negotiation and performance in Mr. Benatash's case. He's also Mr. Benatash's counsel before the military commission. If I could just start with, I think where Your Honor started with my friend this morning, and that is appropriateness, because it is not appropriate for the government to come to this court to save itself from an agreement that it entered into, on which the parties began to perform, and which the Secretary of Defense had plenty of opportunity to not only know about, but to prevent for years. He could have prevented it. Judge Rao, you and I had a lengthy colloquy about the convening authority's powers in the Al-Balul case. You identified several of the powers the Secretary of Defense has over the convening authority. The Secretary of Defense exercised none of those here. Secretary Mattis, just to give you one example, terminated a prior convening authority, which had the effect of terminating pretrial negotiations in this case back in 2018, when the Secretary of Defense came back into office, when President Biden came into office, in 2021, and the Secretary of Defense continued on. He provided no qualifications on the existing convening authority's authority. And more importantly, he put no conditions on General Escalier's authority in August of 2023, and that's significant. Sorry.
Let me ask you a question, though. So if under Fokker Services and Kellogg Brown and Root, the court looked at the question of mandamus this way, first, is there a legal error? And if there is a legal error, you know, is it appropriate to grant mandamus under the Cheney factors? Mm-hmm. So assuming we think that the military judge did err here, you know, on both questions, given the importance of this prosecution, I mean, even if the secretary could have done more, why would this not be an appropriate case for the writ, given how extraordinary the circumstances are and the importance of the government's interest?
I think,
ask you the flip side of the
question.
Ask Ms. Patterson.
And that's completely fair, because I think the very extraordinariness of this case is precisely why mandamus is not appropriate and why ultimately it's not this court's responsibility. It was the government's responsibility They made political decisions, and I don't mean that in a partisan sense. They made decisions as a political branch. They're unhappy with the consequences, perhaps, of those decisions, either due to a lack of controlling the committing authority in advance, to oversight during the long negotiation of this pretrial agreement in which the Secretary of Defense was directly involved, including in August of 2023 when he appointed General Escalier to be the convening authority. And the Secretary took none of those actions. And one of the most important jurisdictional principles of mandamus is that the party have neither a prospective means of potentially attaining the relief that they desire, or that they, had a past means that they forewent for any reason. And that's In re Stone, just to put a case on it.
Your friend on the other side, though, says that if Secretary of Defense had, let's say in June or May, said, I'm withdrawing the power of the convening authority to negotiate and enter into pretrial agreements with these three accused, that that would have been the subject of attack by the accused counsel, because that would have been unlawful interference. Is that right?
Whether the accused would have filed motions, I don't know. It's a capital case. A lot of motions get filed. A lot of motions are denied. To the extent there is a question about how that motion would have likely been viewed by Colonel McCall, who issued the order in this case, he specifically said that the convening authority can have her powers limited ex ante by the Secretary of Defense. And so whether or not that's affected by essentially a revised delegation order or appointment order, I think Colonel McCall's problem, if I can just get to a point with how the Secretary of Defense withdrew the convening authority's authority in this case, is that he wasn't actually just following the ordinary rules and procedure. There's no provision for the Secretary of Defense to just reach in ad hoc. But to the extent the convening authority could have her powers limited ex ante, I don't think Colonel McCall said that she couldn't. She just said the Secretary of Defense didn't do that, which is why we got to the point where we are today.
Would your position be the same if it had been the president himself that said ex nay on these agreements as commander-in-chief? Position about inability to do that, make that ultimate prosecutorial judgment?
Just to be clear, ex ante or ex post?
Same time as the Secretary of Defense here.
Here, so 2 days after the fact? No, our position...
And let's just assume no performance in there. So I just only want to focus on the question of authority.
Yeah, of course. We would say the same problem persists here, because...
To influence by the commander-in-chief on a prosecution.
I just want to make sure I understand the question properly. Would we argue that it's undue influence for the commander-in-chief to say, I don't agree with these plea deals that have been entered, and I think we should do everything we can to get out of them? Is that, I just want to make sure I understood the question.
Do exactly what the Secretary of Defense said here, withdrawing.
I don't know that it would be unlawful influence. I think it's just an improper use of authority that's not authorized by the rules in terms of withdrawing.
Or is it forbidden by the rules?
It's forbidden in the sense that
there's sort of background executive power principles here, so I don't think we have to look for authorization between Article 2 beyond, I'm asking you where it's forbidden for the Secretary, or if it's for the Secretary, I guess it would be the same for the President, mm-hmm. to say, we are not agreeing to this, and put aside performance sure. issue. I just want to know about mm-hmm. the power issue. Where does it say they can't?
Just in the rules and regulation for military trial by military commission. So specifically, Colonel McCall pointed out the regulation for trial by military commission says that once the convening authority has been delegated the power to enter into a pretrial agreement, that power is hers alone. Now, the secretary or the president firing the secretary could certainly change that regulation. But so long as that regulation is in place, we're in the world of, Accardi versus Shaughnessy, U.S. versus Nixon. The government is...
Why doesn't that just mean that the convening authority has the sole authority while the convening authority has the delegation from the secretary? That doesn't mean the secretary can't withdraw the delegation and act as the convening authority himself.
That might be a permissible interpretation of the rules. I don't think it's particularly relevant here, to be perfectly candid. But the way Colonel McCall certainly interpreted the existing rules, which I think is correct, is that the Secretary of Defense is called a superior convening authority in the terminology of the rules. And there are various circumstances under which the superior convening authority can yank little bits of the convening authority's powers out without having to appoint a new convening authority or go through any of the processes that would sort of create set out limitations ex ante. And none of those exist with respect to pretrial agreements. And I think that's all Colonel McCall was saying. We think that's entirely correct, just as a reading of the rules. You could write rules that allow the secretary to have sort of a more a la carte say in the exercise of the convening authority's powers ex ante. But without that legal authority, and that literally that authorization by law, then you would arguably start getting into.
Before the pretrial agreements were entered into, could the secretary withdraw the delegation?
Again, I don't mean to be pedantic about this, but I'm just trying to answer your question exactly. Could the secretary do exactly what he did, saying, I hereby withdraw your authority? I think Colonel McCall said, for very good reason, that's just not contemplated by the rules. Could the secretary have fired the convening authority, which has never happened, to be clear? Colonel Scalia is still the convening authority. Or could the convening authority have been reappointed or given a new document of appointment? Or could the Secretary of Defense have assumed convening authority himself entirely over the case? That's certainly authorized by the rules. All of those options were available. Just this, again, it's sort of a formal, I don't mean to fight your hypothetical. I'm trying to answer.
So your view is under the rules of the military commission rules that the secretary cannot partially withdraw authority?
The secretary is given authority in certain circumstances to include grants of immunity, to essentially withdraw individual authorities and to essentially put a backseat driver's hand on the wheel. Pretrial agreements just aren't one of them. And I think that is what Colonel McCall's objection was to the manner in which the Secretary of Defense was attempting to sort of
Aren't those exceptions, though, things that the secretary can do or the superior convening authority can do short of pulling back the delegation of authority to the convening authority? There are ways of having, say, lawful command influence.
Lawfully, yeah.
Right. But that assumes that the delegation is still in place and the inferior convening authority still has, the delegation from the secretary. But why would we read the rules to suggest those specific examples somehow foreclose the secretary's ability to pull back?
Really, for two reasons. One, the exclusion of the one is the exclusion of the other. But I think more importantly, and this does get to the UI question, which, again, we don't think is actually relevant, unlawful influence case, which is we don't actually think is relevant here. But the unlawful influence provision protects the convening authority except as authorized by law, influence authorized by law. And that is generally interpreted as requiring at least some express authority on those who loom over the convening authority to interfere or intervene in those.
Why isn't the supervision of a prosecutor, view them in this part of the convening authority's authority, there's other things that are not like normal prosecutors.
Sure.
But in this part, entering into a plea agreement, why isn't supervision of a prosecutor's judgment to enter into a plea agreement something that's quite ordinarily a lawful exercise of authority? An attorney general could overrule a U.S. attorney and certainly an AUSA, and no one would say that's improper, right? And there's going to be problems the other way if we think that there's a prosecutorial authority that isn't answerable to anybody and can't be overridden by anyone, particularly in a military context, couldn't be overridden by the commander-in-chief. Seems to me like an extraordinary way to read sort of as a backdrop for this rule.
It's not, at least in these two respects. And one is the fact that the community authority does exercise both judicial and prosecutorial functions that are very much swirled together, that are not always clear cut.
There may be other times, and there's some unusual things for sure that the community authority can do that no prosecutor would get to do in the civilian courts. But it seems to me that entering into a plea agreement is not even arguably an exercise of the judicial functions of the convening authority, which is where you generally see the unlawful influence issues coming up. I assume it's lawful, it's permissible for a convening authority to say, no, we're not agreeing to that plea offer.
So yes, and I just want to put a huge but here, is that, and this is a respect in which the military justice system is a little different, because when the convening authority accepts the pretrial agreement and it becomes binding, it's somewhere between the judge finally accepting the plea in a federal court and, you know, the prosecution signing.
Not here. They still had to go before a judge.
Of course, of course.
So it definitely was not there in this case. This was just a plea agreement. Pre-plea agreement really is a lot of what we're talking about before the plea was actually entered.
That's correct. But in an ordinary federal prosecution, we wouldn't talk about a binding plea agreement until the defendant pleads necessarily.
Not a plea agreement, but you would have a pretrial agreement. And this was proposed as a pretrial agreement.
That's correct.
And the name of it proposed, if I'm correct, the name of these documents is all an offer for pretrial agreement. This is not the plea agreement itself. This is a pretrial agreement. You don't have those in the civilian world?
No, you have. I guess my only point, and
I think you do.
Of course you do, yes.
And no one would say that a prosecutor entering into that was engaged in any sort of judicial function.
And I'll,
pretrial agreement.
I just want to point out, and we did cite some of the cases in our responsive brief, the military just treats that differently because it gets to the convening authority's sentencing discretion, which is traditionally treated as one of the most judicial of the convening authority's judicial acts. And Congress, for a variety of reasons, has been very interested in that over the past 10 years.
Sentencing authority in any form, as in this form, or do you mean the specific sentencing authority to essentially ratchet down a sentence after the military judge rules, which is a different situation?
That is the traditional situation, but again, as a matter of—
There's nothing in the statute provisions I saw there that addressed pretrial agreements as to a recommended sentence to the body. I mean, I get if what the secretary had done is called up the military judge and said, hey,
sure,
don't take this plea.
Of course.
Or if a trial were to go forward and were to call up, you know, the commanding officer or the officers are sitting on the panel itself and say, hey, this is how you should vote. That's what we call undue influence in the judicial function at that point, right? The convening authority just can't pick the judge or the decision makers. But that seems to me, what authority is there that the prosecutorial judgment to enter into a prospective, a pretrial agreement that has contained within it a prospective plea and sentencing, you know, range at least. If there were, I mean, I guess you could have pleas that sometimes have lockdown time periods and others will have ranges and things like that. But assuming that's what the prosecutor is doing, either one of those, what is your best authority that supervision as to that judgment would ever by, now I'm calling the super convening authority,
yeah,
would be undue influence in military justice?
Again, I just want to say we don't need to win on this argument to win in this case, sure. But to the
I'm
extent,
just trying to understand
no, absolutely, 100%. But to because the convening authority also makes promises in the pretrial agreement that the convening authority is bound to follow at the end of the process, which are exercises of the convening authority's judicial discretion. And so to the extent they're entering into PTAs in the military context is viewed as one of the convening authority's protected acts, that's at least in part why, because the convening authority sits as the alpha and the omega of the military trial process. And so when the convening authority is making representations or promises and binding themselves or their officers, successors, to take certain actions at the end, which are unquestionably judicial in the military system for which they have unfettered discretion, et cetera, that is just why this is treated as something that is protected generally from unlawful influence protections. But again, I don't think that is, first of all, essential to, you know, to essentially denying or dismissing the writ in this case. And I also kind of candidly think it's sort of a distracting point, because the only reason we're having this sort of rococo discussion about how, you know, who is the unmoved mover in the military justice system, it's because the Secretary of Defense didn't take any number of the steps that everyone agrees the Secretary could have taken over the span of many years when he was very much on notice that there were pretrial negotiations in this case, that he was a party to the terms of those pretrial negotiations, and appointed General Escalier. I point back again to August of 2023 as really a pivotal time, because that's not only the time when General Escalier is appointed as convening authority, it's when the Secretary is being given explicit warnings by member of Congress not to enter into this deal, that it's not in the public interest to enter into this deal. And it's right after this court decided the second Al-Bulul decision, which declined to revisit the 2020 Al-Bulul decision on the scope of the convening authority's authority. And both in the argument, in the briefing, in the public commentary, indeed in an amicus brief filed by the chief defense counsel pursuant to an on-bank petition in this court, the plea negotiations, the ongoing plea negotiations in this very case was a central cause of concern to say, hey, to the extent there is any concern about the convening authority exercising unfettered discretion in certain areas, it may very well be in the resolution of the 9-11 case. And as this court's jurisprudence stand, that's a decision the convening authority can make without any intervention whatsoever by the Secretary of Defense. This court denied review, and that remains the law of the circuit. And so the
authority, without, they don't have to have the Secretary of Defense's sign off.
I'm sorry.
They don't have to have the Secretary of Defense's sign off, but that's different than saying the Secretary of Defense couldn't disagree and override.
No. This was squarely put before this court because the very question was, could the convening authority make final determinations that were binding upon the government and therefore, you know, implicate the appointments clause without supervising authority by a principal officer, i.e. the Secretary of Defense? Mm-hmm. The government at that time said, you bet you can. We said that creates a pretty stark potential accountability problem, which all manner of individuals, to include, as I mentioned, the amici filed in this court, noted. And this court, you know, ruled that, yes, the convening authority can bind the federal government, including in this very case. And so to the extent it's the government's burden to come to this court to show not only a clear and indisputable right to relief, but to show that it's appropriate for this court to ultimately take responsibility for what, you know, I admit are probably very good faith objections to how this case is being resolved in some quarters. But that's not this court's problem. It's the government's problem. And this is an interbranch dispute where the government has come to the federal courts because of the secretary's essentially failure to either intervene earlier or to oversee a subordinate that this court held repeatedly he had the ability to oversee.
The secretary has said up front in appointing this convening authority, you know, go forth, handle these cases, exercise your best judgment. But if there are going to be plea agreements with A, B, C, D, however long the list wanted to be, I have to sign those. Would that be lawful?
Yes, 705A says exactly that, subject to such limitations as the secretary may impose, right? I may have gotten the word.
That wouldn't have been attacked as unlawful interference or undue influence.
I can't tell you what motions defendants in a capital case will or will not file, but if, again, just going by Colonel McCall's ruling on this very issue, I'm pretty sure that motion would have failed precisely because it is authorized by law. To wit, 705A. And again, I think this whole question about the Secretary of Authority is a bit of a red herring because it's primarily just a question of form and how the Secretary of Defense has sought to intervene as opposed to his actual power to intervene at many, 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 many decision points in advance of.
I mean, that power to limit the convening authority is always there. And so the only question is whether it can be limited after signing rather than before.
After signing what, Your Honor?
Signing the agreement rather than before.
Yes, in that.
A review of that decision, essentially.
By the Secretary, no. This court, that was squarely before this court in Al-Bulul, I promise you. And this court was not moved by that at the time. Mm-hmm. And it shouldn't be moved by it here, particularly because, and I know this is a slightly different part of the case, but I do think it's relevant. The government and the respondents in this case did begin performance of promises under the pretrial agreement contained in the
different question.
Which I understand is a different question, but to the extent the secretary, you know, was, you know, too late and a dollar short in trying to do it at any point after the entry of the plea, several days went by to include proceedings on the record, to include the questioning of a witnesses, to include the following of the promise to forbear from either following motions or asserting any rights, which are not just contained. I know the government focused.
Where's the promise to forbear?
It's in two places, at least in the Muhammad pretrial agreement. First of all, the one the government often points to is paragraph 23. And the first says the accused agreed to waive all motions at the time of the entry of the plea, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The next provision is
entry of the plea, not entry of the guilty plea and not signing of this agreement.
That's correct. Yes, we don't fight that. But if you go then to the very next sentence, it says the accused agrees to file no more motions except for agrees to file no more motions except for essentially scheduling purposes, procedural scheduling purposes. But I would also point.
Is that sentence not governed by the same time frame upon entry and acceptance of the accused guilty plea?
No, if I could give a grammatical as well as a logical reason, one is the antecedent governs the prior sentence, not the following. Furthermore, just in context, that sentence would actually make no sense, particularly with its carve out respecting scheduling, if it had to postdate the accused entry of the plea. This is exactly what the government keeps complaining that they need to see, a forward looking promise that postdates the agreement in this case. That's a forward looking further agree promise not to make any motions except for scheduling. And that's precisely what the accused did in this case. That's one of the main reasons they didn't question this witness. But in addition, I would also point I'm not sure that this is out of seal. I think it is, so I won't say the text of it. But if you go to paragraph 5 of the pretrial agreement, this part of it,
I believe that's still sealed.
Is paragraph 5 still out of seal? So I would then just.
Oh, no, paragraph 5. Sorry. I'm sorry. Are you talking Roman 5 or?
I'm sorry. No, numeral 5. Paragraph 5, sub Roman 4.
It's still sealed.
That's sealed.
Okay. So without saying anything that's out of seal, I would simply point to all of the language immediately following the comma, following the precatory clause. Which again is a forward-looking promise.
I want to talk about that a little bit more when we go into sealed session.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I don't want to skirt the line on that, but I would just sort of point to that again.
You're skirting anything.
I'm sorry.
It might help us to understand better your point.
Okay, but again, that's another forward-looking promise that was clearly in the contemplation of the
notion that you all agreed that language, which is similar but not identical in all three agreements. Seems to me after, you know, there's much discussion, and I apologize, like the same transcript appears in two different places, and I'm in JA 225 to 26 here.
Yes, sir.
Which is this, I think the same pages that appear earlier. I just highlighted and read the wrong ones.
I apologize, Your Honor. We were putting the JA together.
Well, everything was going fast. So JA 225, and this is all unclassified, I take it, all unsealed, I believe. Is unclassified and doesn't say sealed. So quickly tell me if I'm not supposed to say this out loud, but y'all been quoting parts of it, so I think it's fine. So after the government had said its thing about with the waiver, they can't, you know, do anything, they can't participate, they can't, with the waiver, all motions, they can't actively continue to participate in any of the contested litigation. Right? That's the quote that's been read many times from the government.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then
I think it's page 233, if I recall.
The government one I have is on 224.
Okay, I apologize.
No, it could be in here three times. I don't know. But anyhow, so the government says that. And then Mr. Connell, who's a defense counsel, says, and this is the bottom half of the page, seems to disagree with the government's view. You know, it could be that they have legal, you know, they haven't abandoned all legal rights by pleading guilty or even agreeing to plead guilty. They may have some legal position on something that happens that is separate from pursuing relief under a motion. They may have an objection or a privilege or something else that they may wish to assert. So that seems to be direct disagreement with the government's reading of that paragraph. And then I'll just finish it. And then on the next page, 226, Colonel McCall says, I agree with the government and with you, Mr. Connell. So the government, I don't read the military judge here as saying, I agree with the government, they can't do anything. He says, I agree with you and the government, and here's how we're going to thread this needle. And that's down on lines sort of 12 to 16. Here's what I'm going to do. All right, they say you can't do anything. You say you have a right to do there. You still have a right to file objections and participate. What I'm going to do is go forward with Mr. Ali because he doesn't have a guilty plea. We're going to go forward and question this witness with Mr. Ali. because I'm not going to hold everything up. There's the guy who doesn't have a plea agreement.
For sure.
And essentially, we're going to freeze your situation. So he's not agreeing with Mr. Trevitt that you can't file motions, make objections, do anything. Or sorry, not file motions. You can't make objections. You can't participate in hearings. Not even great. There's nothing about questioning witnesses. He's not agreeing with that. He's agreeing with both of you. We're just going to freeze yours. And then when we get this all sorted, one way or the other, there'll be a plea or not. But if there's not, then you're going to have your full trial rights. All right. So it seems to me when you say everyone understood we couldn't do these things, that that, in fact, is not accurate. I don't mean that in the pejorative
sense. No.
That is not what the record reflects as I read it, that, in fact, defense counsel said, no, we see things, we beg to differ. And the judge said, you both got points here. We're going to avoid it for now. We'll just go forward with Mr. Ali, and then we'll come back once we, you know, with the status of what you're going to participate in, once we know what's happening with these pleas. If that, tell me first if that's just a wrong reading of this record, and if so, why? And if it is an accurate reading of this record, then isn't that pretty strong evidence that, in fact, that whatever the paragraph 23 and the equivalent paragraphs in the other agreements were, it was not a limitation at this stage of the proceeding on not questioning this witness. It was sort of a procedural case management judgment by the military judge to just to separate these proceedings for now.
So I just want to, I think you not maybe not misreading it, but I do, I think this may be just a point of confusion given the sequencing of some of the pages.
I've got plenty of confusion, I'm sure.
So no,
am I in the wrong? Are there more pages somewhere else?
Is the part you're referring to, I believe, occurs after the secretary attempted to withdraw. And there was a question about what the modus vivendi would be going forward. Insofar as the government,
I think this is the August 1 hearing.
Is this the August 1 hearing? I just want to make sure I understand.
Because back on 222, it says, I think, sorry, this is where I think Mr. Trivett stands up and says, yes, because a few pages before 219, I announced, they're announcing the pretrial agreements on 219. Mm. Now, if there's pages that were taken out here and I don't know, then let me know. I see.
I'm sorry. I misunderstood. Yeah. Yes. Okay.
And then on 222, the judge says, I know the government said perhaps motions were perhaps. I mean, the judge hasn't even seen the agreement at this point, so I don't know how the judge could agree.
That's not correct. It was before him, but I
just, I mean, it'd been just done. That's correct. And he says, I need time. I mean, that was some of the time.
I need time to judge.
I need time to sort this stuff and read this stuff. And you know, that asks what the questions of what motions are waivable, and we're going to need the parties to be prepared to address that. And I'm planning on putting out something. So he's trying to figure out what this all means. So the notion that the military judge is signing off on what it meant seems to me hard to reconcile with that. And that's when we get into, okay, well, now what are we going to do today with this suppression hearing and the witness in the Ali case? And that's when we get to the, you know, you have the government says, well, we think you can't do anything. And defense counsel says, oh, we don't agree with that. And the judge says, I agree with both of you. Let's just go forward with Mr. Ali, be here if you want. But there's no place here that I read where either defense counsel or the military judge is saying, we agree with the government. We can't do anything. We are hereby performing under the agreement. I wouldn't have to add those words, but in so many words, we are performing under the agreement by not questioning.
So I also just wanted to, you're correct about the sequencing. So I was, no, it's quite right. You're correct about the sequencing, but also Mr. Connell is not counsel for any of the respondents. He's counsel for Mr. Ali. And so, you know, first of all, I would just say his interpretation of a pretrial agreement for which his client is not a party and for which he potentially has an adverse.
Mr. Connell is for Mr. Ali. Is that what you just
said? That's correct. Yeah. Mr. Ali or Mr. Albalucci, as he's sometimes called on the record, not any one of the respondents.
I mean, I don't hear any of the defense attorneys there saying he's got it wrong. They have legal, you know, they haven't abandoned all. He's not talking about Mr. Ali. They may have some things. So they're still a part of this case, just in a much different posture. And all I can say is that, and you could say, well, that's just Mr. Ali. But then the judge says, I agree with Mr. Connell as well as
So if I may, Your Honor, and I promise I'm not quibbling you.
Sorry if I got the wrong person.
No, not at all. Again, Mr. Connell is a separately represented party who, again, may have adverse interests to our client, is not part of the pretrial agreement. And so I wouldn't rely on his particular interpretation of the pretrial agreement. He also says quite a lot. And so it's not entirely clear there what precisely Judge McCall is saying he agrees to, specifically respecting his representations, because a lot is going on there. But I think the more valuable exchanges come about 10 pages later, when counsel for respondents and the government do begin to address these issues squarely. One is where the government says, at this point, I believe this is 233, and I'm sure someone will yell at me from behind me if I've gotten the precise page correct, where the government says, at this point, it is our view that the accused essentially may not participate. Someone can give me the precise page site. I will give it to Your Honor. But then I think just as significant.
If I can back you up. I'm sorry. 230, then have the military judge saying, here's what this hearing is. Remember, he just said, I agree with both these points.
I guess
the right person speaking. He agreed with both points when it was said that they haven't given up everything, have a right to be here, have a right to participate, or may have a right to participate. Leave that open. And what we're doing is we're going forward with the Ali case.
Mm-hmm.
We're not going forward with Muhammad, the Al-Hawassi, or the Benatosh case. We're just going forward with the Ali case. Any concerns or need for clarification on the next page? I'm seeing head shakes. I assume that's not just Mr. Connell's. All right. So now you're on 233. So we're only going forward with the Ali case today. And so you were on 233. Is that right?
Sure. So I think the colloquy is then beginning on 223, which is Mr. Trivett, who's counsel for the government.
Sorry, 23 or 33?
Sorry, exactly, 233, excuse me. When he's, again, explaining the understanding of the agreement between the parties, i.e. counsel for the government as well as counsel for the respondents, which does include him saying, at this point, it is our position that the accused may not essentially seek affirmative relief or question witness,
There's a lot of talk on 33, but I'm going to have to get together and talk to defense counsel and figure out what's going on here. We'll have to talk to clients over the weekend, which all would be after the secretary acts.
Sure.
I'm sorry. It's just been kind of confusing.
No, I apologize. We are
each other.
But if I can jump ahead before, because I'm having a little trouble just finding the precise quote from counsel, which is in our respondent's brief at some length, is it's just as valuable, though, I think, and again, far more valuable than what.
I assume you're talking about the 237 language.
Yes, that's where counsel for Mr. Hassawi, Mr. Ruiz, speaks up.
Your client's counsel are not speaking in here?
That's correct. Well, Mr. Sowers, I believe, does speak later, although I'm not sure if that part is in this particular colloquy. Mm-hmm. But what Mr. Ruiz, who does represent the respondent, Mr. Al-Hassawi, says is we are foregoing questioning of this witness. That is, we view that as.
Oh, it says we have not been engaging in any examination of the witness when it hasn't even started yet.
That's correct.
Okay.
But
I don't even understand what that sentence means. We haven't been engaged in a witness when there's no witness that's been not engaged.
Because at.
We're abstaining. I mean, it all sounds like he's doing it right now, but the witness isn't there. The judge has said, we're just going forward with Mr. Ali's case.
That's correct.
Well, it doesn't make sense to me.
The reason Mr.
Unless he's trying to block the government, if it's somehow to revoke or remove, well, we've done and performed. I mean, that's a very strategic and wise statement, but. It doesn't seem to fit factually what was going on at this hearing.
Again, I apologize. We're having some JA, lining up the JA sites. But the
very top of 230, I mean, it starts.
Oh, yes, I understand. 237. That's correct.
That doesn't make sense to me. And what seems, I'm sorry to talk to you while you're trying to look. It just seems really important to me when the judge said, agreeing with you both, whatever that means, when you had two contrary statements. And I take your point that it wasn't by counsel here, but I think you're all sort of there together in the room, I assume.
That's correct.
And no one's going, not talking for me. And the judge says, I actually am adopting the view that they're not giving up rights to make objections, assert privileges, these types of things. And certainly they can be here if they want in the hearings, but we're just, I'm going to thread the needle right now by saying today, this is now just Mr. Ali's case. And when this is all sorted, then it'll be a plea agreement and we'll have nothing more to do on the questioning witnesses front, or there won't be. And then we'll have your hearing on questioning this witness.
So if I can just respond, you know, in turn, just to the questions, and I apologize, we've had to just get the citations all lined up, the specific point is the government says at this point, with the waiver of all motions from three of the four accused.
You're on which page?
It's reported as JA 233 in our brief, but I have a feeling that may not be 100% correct because I have not been able to read and listen to you at the same time and find it quickly. But it can also be found, because this is, I think, was crucial both to Colonel McCall and the CMCR's own reading of the record. So it's cited both at Petitioner Appendix Exhibit A, which is Colonel McCall's ruling, page 26, as well as CMCR decision, which is Petitioner Appendix B at page 17. And the quote, again, specifically, this is the day this is counsel for the government. At this point, with the waiver of all motions from the three of the four accused, they can't actively participate they can't actively continue to participate in any of the contested litigation based upon the pretrial agreement, mm-hmm. right? In order to be compliant, they cannot continue to participate. The witness
that made that statement, Mr. Triffitt, did he sign these agreements?
He did. Yes, Your Honor. He signed the stipulation of fact.
Did he bother to tell anybody where on earth he saw that language in the agreement?
Again, I don't mean to get into mm-hmm. two things that are under seal, but certainly I think paragraph 5, as well as obviously paragraph 23, which we've been, I think, spending the most time talking about because it's unsealed, which is the prospective promise to file no more motions, mm-hmm. Which would include any predicates to the filing of motions. As well,
that's a pretty big question, at least Colonel McCall at the time.
I disagree. I think Colonel McCall fully understood what the parties were saying, particularly when Mr. Ruiz. I
agree when a defense counsel said they still have the right to make objections. They still have the right to assert privilege. They still need to be here. And so he was not thinking that this was a complete shutdown of defense counsel. Now, to be fair, he might have later come to that conclusion, and he said, I need to get briefing on what this all means, particularly this withdrawal of motions language. He said, I need to hear from the parties on what that means. But it seems a lot then to read into this hearing, which is the only thing that is apart from the stipulation facts, but for these purposes, mm-hmm. for purposes of that paragraph performance, this is the only thing people point to. And it strikes me as
very
confusing.
No. I'll do my best to provide some clarity about it. Mr. Ruiz's statements that the respondents, and at least Mr. Hassawi, but I think this is true of all the respondents, were engaged in what he referred to as specific performance. This witness had been on the stand the day before. And so by announcing that even though I understand
they questioned him the day before,
I don't believe so because it was the government's witness. They didn't have the opportunity the day before, but it was certainly that it, to the extent there's a tense sort of ambiguity in the tense of what Mr. that this is an ongoing proceeding, and this has sort of altered the day's, you know, the expectation of what would happen that day.
Said it after the judge had already altered the day to be, all right, this is just Ali's hearing.
Well, again, this is partly because, a lot is going on in this hearing, and so I don't blame you for being slightly confused by what's happening. But this is also after the government said, we fear or anticipate a lot of the prospect of some unlawful influence on the proceedings. And so we're going to need to move quickly. And so I think certainly when Mr. Ruiz made that remark, he was very much, you know, just making sure everyone on the record understood he was performing under the pretrial.
He was planning to perform.
No, he was performing by forbearing.
Forbearing from questioning. There was no witness on the stand that had yet been for defense counsel. He was predicting future behavior that, in fact,
he carried out.
Did not get carried out because the judge said, this is Ali day. It's no longer your day.
But
that's how I'm threading this needle of these conflicting arguments that I'm getting from an agreement. Y'all just free agreements. Y'all just dumped in my lap. I haven't had time to look at.
Sure. But the government itself acknowledges, and I think this is on JA 150, 152, that this witness was relevant, not just to Mr. Ali, but to everybody.
Absolutely.
And
that person taken the stand that day.
They did, Your Honor.
I'm sorry. I know.
I'm sorry.
And
I'm sorry.
The judge not said today is just Ali hearing day. As free as your situation for now. It seems, you know, he just didn't have enough information at this point and was getting conflicting arguments. He's freezing that. And if the judge has already said, this is not your suppression hearing day, it's just Mr. Ali. If you can show me on the record where the judge, and maybe if it's some other part of the record, where once this witness was on the stand, counsel for one of the three defendants was there, and the judge said, would you like to ask any questions to the non-Ali counsel? Would you like to ask any questions? And they all said, we can't, in sort of the terms that we've been talking about here, that would be much more helpful. It's just these pages here were not, we're raising more questions than answers for me.
And we apologize, and we're happy to provide the full.
Oh, no, the transcript is what it is.
No, but we're happy to provide the full transcript of the hearings that week, which I think will provide more content.
Did that happen, do you know? When the witness was on the stand, were counsel for these three defendants still in the room? And yes?
Yes, they were.
Okay. And did any of them, did the judge ever say, do you want to ask questions? Did the judge suggest that they had the opportunity to ask questions at that point? And they said, essentially, we can't in the terms.
Well, the day before, the respondents had been questioning this witness. It was a government witness, but I was just corrected by my colleague if I misspoke before. Yes, exactly. And then forbeared from proceeding further so that only.
I need the evidence of forbeared because I'm reading the judge as having said, a lot going on here. So instead of this, at the beginning of the day when he drank his coffee and came on in, he thought this was going to be a suppression hearing for Mr. Ali, Mr. Muhammad, Mr. Benatash, Mr. Al-Hassawi. And then he says, oh, hang on. I hear different things coming from you, and here's what we're going to do. We're going forward with Mr. Ali. His case is going forward today.
Mm-hmm.
Not any of these three defendants' cases, not their motions to suppress, not their interest in this witness. That's frozen. And we'll sort out what happens with that once we see if these pleas go forward or not. You're telling me that's a wrong interpretation and that there's something later in the record that shows he, in fact, was still inviting you all to ask questions and then you forbore.
So I can get you a specific answer to any sort of invitation. I don't think that happened, though, precisely because of the colloquy at the beginning and everyone.
It might have not happened precisely because the judge had already said, You all are frozen off for today.
Well, not just frozen off.
Be here and watch, but this is not your suppression hearing. This is no longer your suppression hearing today.
But even that, let me. I'll just say two things to that, Your Honor. Even that would be the promise to fulfilling the promise to forbear from further litigation, which is precisely what Colonel McCall found. Secondarily,
how is that forbearing when the judge has, as a matter of procedure, having not yet read the agreements, but wanting to wisely do no harm, not step on anything. Just said, we're just setting, it's almost like freezing the status quo. We're just not doing anything with your case today. I'm not saying whether you could question or couldn't question.
Sure.
That's how he could somehow agree with both Mr. Trevitt and Mr. Connell.
I don't want to overread his agreement with Mr. Connell, but I also do think that if only not in
objecting,
that's fine, but in not objecting, certainly all of the accused, if they were actively participating, would object to questions from Mr. Connell or for the government, particularly given the fact that at this point, Mr. Connell, they went from being in a joint trial to adverse to him, if only because he had not entered into a pretrial negotiation and they were stipulating to facts that implicated him. So in all of those circumstances, they were forbearing from, you know, the ordinary conduct of litigation in these cases, which, again, we're happy to provide more record sites to this court that hopefully won't just add to the morass. But it is routine in this trial for everyone to sort of click through and participate.
I assume everyone was filing a motion to suppress.
That's correct. It was a joint motion to suppress.
Everybody wanted to question this witness about their motion to suppress. Everyone might have their own different, might be some common questions, might be different questions. But every attorney had, every client had their own attorney. Right. And all I'm saying is that we have this world that the day before was, I don't know if there were other defendants as well, but with four, at a minimum here, four defendants with four motions, all wanting to question the same witness through four separate counsel.
That's correct.
And then as I read what Colonel McCall did here is when plea agreements dropped suddenly for him for three of them, didn't even have time to read and had questions about what it meant and was hearing conflicting arguments. He just said, I agree with both of you, I can only think it's not deciding who has to do what. The way I'm going to deal with that is this is no longer a four-party case. This is today. This is a one-defendant case on a one-defendant suppression motion, and that defendant can go forward and question this witness. And the rest, by the judge, as a matter of, I think, wisely not stepping on anything of which he hasn't had an opportunity to inform himself, it just said, we're just not formally severing. He was clear about that, but we are just setting that off for now. So if we read that as this was no longer Mr. Muhammad's day for motion to suppress and that question this witness or any of the other two, then nobody forbore from anything.
Well, it does sound.
The judge said, I can't sort this right now. I don't want to hold up Mr. Ali.
Of course.
It's not him making a judgment about, I need to do this for your performance. That's
well,
we need to sort this out later.
He's making that judgment as a needing to do it. Precisely because that's exactly what counsel for the government and respondents are telling him. But even if you disagree with me on that.
No, but certainly not needing to do it as a matter of contract language or performance of the plea agreements because he got contradictory arguments and he hasn't had time to read it. And you earlier in the thing, he's like, I need to hear from the parties what this clause means. So I don't think there's any way we can read his actions as interpreting the defendant's obligations under the agreement at that moment.
I can disagree with you just on this one specific ground, which I also think is why this case is completely inappropriate for mandamus, is that if there are these sort of ambiguities about precisely what everyone thought and meant and understood to be performance or not at the time, Colonel McCall was unquestionably in the best position to decide those questions. And he affirmatively, clearly, explicitly decided that when the government made this representation and when he instructed parties about the modus vivendi, that is exactly what they were doing, was performing under the terms of the agreement.
But it's contradicted by sort of a textual reading of the transcript. What do we do?
I certainly don't think it's clearly and indisputably contradicted.
I agree with both attorneys.
Again, one of those attorneys.
You all agreed with him. Doesn't matter. There was an argument from a defense counsel that this wasn't all given up. And he agreed with that. He adopted that reading, as well as the one that he adopted that they can't do anything, and yes, they can do something.
But I don't see.
Actually, I don't know how to interpret that. You know,
he's a
thoughtful guy, and I'm going to say that I think then it makes perfect sense when. I don't mean to beat a dead horse.
No.
With a judge hat on, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
When things are dumped in your lap, and you haven't had yet time to read anything, and you're getting contradictory arguments, to just say, boom, we'll deal with that later. But there's no reason any of this should slow down Mr. Ali. No one has disputed that was a reasonable thing for him to do.
That's correct.
So the question is, in doing that, was he somehow answering the debate between the two parties about what an agreement he hadn't yet read yet, and in particular, a clause that he said, I need briefing on? That just seems an implausible reading of the transcript.
I frankly disagree, Your Honor, and I don't think Colonel McCall was acting in bad faith when he interpreted his own conduct on the bench in his final ruling.
I'm not suggesting bad faith. To be crystal clear.
Yeah.
You know, you learn things over time, and that affects sometimes how you look backwards. Look at that 48-hour window here, which is so important.
Sure, but again, if we're parceling out precisely what Mr. Connell, who is not a party to this agreement, is saying about the way the proceedings should go forward and what Mr. Trivett, who is counsel for the government and a party and a signatory, indeed a drafter of both this agreement and stipulation of fact, are saying. And Colonel McCall is saying, I agree with both of you, and not specifying precisely what he agreed with. I think the fairest reading of that statement in context is he agrees with Mr. Trivett that the pretrial agreement requires forbearance, contains promises to forbear on the parts of respondents. And yet, if you remind me, he agrees with Mr. Connell that that does not require immediate severance of the defendants from the case and allows, because that is most of what, and we may read it differently, but sorry.
So when I look at that statement by Mr. Connell, he says, they haven't abandoned all legal rights by pleading guilty. They may have some legal position on something that is separate from pursuing relief under a motion. So there he seems to be saying that they agreed to waive all motions, but they may still be able to assert some sort of objection that one doesn't have to make by filing a motion or making a motion. And he says they may have an objection or privilege or something else they wish to assert. I mean, if, for instance, a witness was going to testify about attorney-client privilege information for one of these respondents, would that be precluded? Would an objection to eliciting that testimony be precluded by the pretrial agreement?
It might be. I think it would depend on the context. It would probably look a lot like collateral order doctrine litigation, perhaps. But I also want to emphasize that, again, not only is Mr. Connell not a party to the pretrial agreements in this case, he did not have a copy of the pretrial agreement. He has no basis to know what these pretrial agreements require or don't require. And again, I would point back to paragraph 5, which I think is far more explicit as a prospective performance to cover the kind of forbearance that we're talking about here. And even paragraph 23 is, if you don't agree with me, that paragraph 23, I think, covers it as well. There's a bit of a belt and suspenders quality to some of this pretrial agreement. So, these are promises. And I'll point to one other promise that Colonel McCall didn't find. It's not part of his findings of performance, but I think is explicit on the record, and explicit on the record that we gave you and relates to a lot of the discussion we've been having, which is paragraphs 57 and 58 of the pretrial agreement. And this is under out of seal because it is cited in our briefing, explicitly require there.
Which one? I still have that marked. Is that wrong?
I'm sorry?
Of the Muhammad?
Yes, and of the Muhammad one. I apologize.
That's still sealed.
That's sealed.
That is sealed.
We'll
definitely
add that to the.
It's quoted in our brief, so I'm a little. I apologize if there was some back and forth there.
Y'all blacked it out for us.
So, I'm sorry. But specifically, with respect to the promises, and again, there are terms in we agree to language to seek the expedition of the entry of the pleas and further proceedings in the cases. And all the parties, all the respondents in who are governed by the pretrial agreement do that at the very outset of this hearing. And that, if nothing else, that's clear performance, that's forward-looking performance, that's performance after the agreement, that's affirmative acts. It's not just a promise to forbear. And that was a very valuable promise to the government. And this is unsealed because it is part of our.
Was that argued below? Because I don't hear any mention, remember any mention of these, that performance.
Colonel McCall did not. Colonel McCall did not make a specific finding.
Court of Military Commission Review did not either.
No, they did not.
Argued to them that this was the relevant performance.
It was, or it's at least tied up in this broader question that you were having with my friend about the stipulation of fact, because.
Okay, that's a very different question.
it is a different question, but I do want to the performance on the stipulation follows the performance under paragraphs 57 and 58, precisely because one of the reasons why the convening authority had given instructions to Mr. Trivett to ensure that the stipulation of fact was signed before it was provided to the convening authority for agreement was so that there wouldn't be these kinds of sort of post hoc dickering problems that could delay the entry of the pleas and protract these proceedings anymore. And so 57 and 58 are directly pointing at the expedition of the proceedings, which is also why.
58 does not actually seem relevant to this discussion. Much later,
maybe it's just 57.
We can talk more about whether this argument was properly raised below and someone might need to go into sealed session.
That's good. Well, it's not our burden. I mean, you know, to the extent we're going to engage in like fairly fine parsing of the transcript in this case and fairly ambiguous statements that Colonel McCall is making respecting counsel who are not, you know, representing anyone in this case as a basis to conclude there's at least uncertainty.
So your position is that these are findings of fact?
Yes, aspects of them are finding of fact. Yes.
So the question of what the pretrial agreements requires a question of law.
That's generally correct. Yes.
It's a kind of contract interpretation.
That's correct.
We would review de novo. So what precisely then are the facts or the findings of fact that you think would be subject to a different standard?
So, you know, I know everyone's been digging into the restatement, but I think the clearest term that would be relevant to the findings of fact is what is performance? But performance is traditionally for hundreds of years treated as a jury question in contract cases, whether or not someone has or has not performed. And so to the extent questions of performance were or findings of performance were made by the fact finder.
That the real world fact questions of who did what, which really isn't so much in dispute here, as opposed to whether certain factual conduct counted as performance under the agreement. And I would think the latter question would be something viewed de novo.
Well, I think
law and fact at a minimum.
The lengthy colloquy you and I had trying to precisely interpret exactly what the parties were not doing at the hearing, I think suggests precisely the kind of ambiguity, which is why this is a question of fact, which is the kind of question that's committed to a fact finder who's able to see the party's behavior. And again, more importantly, just to basic contract interpretation, where there is ambiguity about what a term means. And we don't think paragraph 23 and certainly not paragraph 5 is ambiguous. But if there's any ambiguity about what those promises entail, the course of performance of parties is a question of fact and it was also used to resolve any ambiguities.
What's the course of performance here? Is just the hearings?
Yes, the behavior of the parties on the hearings.
What's your best case that course of conduct can be determined by a single event? I think a lot of case law and restatement expect that it's more than, it's a series of actions.
To the extent there is a series of events, I would point this court to I'm pretty sure it's paragraph or page 149 forward of the joint appendix, which is the hearing to follow that follows the Secretary of Defense's attempt to withdraw. Where again, the question of how do we proceed forward and the respondents.
So, but a hearing that occurred after with the withdrawal, if the withdrawal was valid, then that wouldn't really be a course of performance, would it?
Well, it goes to how do the parties interpret the terms of the contract if it were valid? So, you know, the question after Secretary withdrew is not what the contract meant. It's what the contract required, assuming it is still in effect. And again, the course of performance of the parties was that the forbearance from litigation that everyone had understood to be required under the performances due under the contract before had to continue. And the government, and this is on page 157, the government is squarely asked whether or not that is their understanding of how they should proceed. And the transcript's a little sort of opaque exactly what happens. But what
language you're talking about. More opaque transcripts. We can't have enough of them.
So on paragraph, I believe it's page 157. After they go through the continued requirement to forbear from questioning witnesses, objecting to questions, filing motions, et cetera, it's put to the parties that this is the way they're going to go forward. It's put to Mr. Trivett, and then anything other from the defense or prosecution. Mr. Trivett, can I have just a second to consult, sir? Of course. Counsel confer. Nothing from the government, sir. So if nothing else, the government acquiesced in this interpretation and has continued to acquiesce in this interpretation.
Are you trying to make an estoppel argument?
It would be a pretty good estoppel argument, but I don't even think you need to go that far because I do think, you know, to the extent your honor makes a good point, right? One hearing is not a course of performance, But to the extent that that court, what was understood to be required at that initial hearing, continues to be understood by all the necessary parties to include the military commission judge, and without objection at any point by the government, I think is pretty, again, the best evidence for what a particular term of the contract means.
Who drafted the pretrial agreements?
Mostly the government, and specifically the stipulation of fact. It was almost entirely written by the government.
But what about the pretrial agreement?
That was written between the parties. The terms were negotiated between the parties, but the government was the principal draft because the government actually initiated the negotiations in March of 22. So this is at the government's initiative. The government is coming forward with both the terms of the agreement as well as the stipulation of fact. And so, again, if we're breaking out sort of 1L contract law, again, contra proferentum, the government is the primary drafter of this contract. And so, you know, if there's a dispute about the interpretation, certainly.
Does that apply when you've jointly drafted it?
I'm sorry?
Does that apply, that principle apply when you've jointly drafted it?
I'm sorry.
Does that principle apply of construing it against the government when it's been jointly drafted?
Generally, no. And I'm not pinning our case on that. But
I'm not pinning your case. I'm just,
yeah.
Maybe now I'm actually
asking that question. Curious.
Yeah, yeah.
Was there sufficient participation by the defense counsel?
We don't dispute that these terms were negotiated by all the parties, but the contract, the agreement was put forward by the government and then modifications were made to conform to a particular defense team's interests.
Essentially co-written.
I'm sorry?
So it's essentially co-written.
Yes, we're not running away from that. But again, to the extent
the government case then that would construe language in it still against the government when it's co-written.
I'm not claiming there is, so I wouldn't say there would be. But to the extent the parties to the agreement understood it to mean something, behaved precisely as you would expect, given that commonly understood meaning, continue to behave that way up until, you know, to today, as far as I understand, without objection from the government below, I just think that's course of performance, you know, in any normal contractual situation, and particularly when the stakes are this high, particularly where it's not as if the government doesn't know that this case is coming ultimately perhaps to this court. The government had plenty of opportunities and plenty of off ramps, frankly, around this deal to begin with. And I know I've been up here a long time, and so I'm not trying to belabor your patience. If there are no further questions, I'll just sit down. But at this late date, when there's been so much delay, it's not the job of this court to delay a case that has already been delayed arguably by 20 years for reasons entirely of the government's own making, another 20 years or more. I heard the government say, respecting their right to post-trial relief, that this could take another 3 years before this case returned to this court. 3 years in the life of this case, in the life of Guantanamo, that strikes, I was like, yeah, that sounds both reasonable and pretty brisk, because the alternative is, and we lay it out in our brief, this case is not coming back to this court potentially until 2050. And that's shocking. That is shocking. And that's not something certainly that equity commands. And given the government's own conduct in this case, I don't think they've made a case for mandamus.
So is your co-counsel going to address whether entry into the stipulation is beginning performance, or do you have anything else you want to say on that issue?
Your Honor's asked a lot of questions about that in advance, and we would simply concur with the position that entry into a stipulation of fact does occur at the time it's accepted, in the same way that entry into a marriage begins when both parties say, I do. And just because the husband says I do first doesn't mean that he has entered into the marriage or before the wife has. And so we entirely agree with the analysis that there are circumstances, to be sure. And I think some of the cases Your Honor pointed out, specifically the Pruner case, are one of them, where stipulations and all the performances do under the pretrial agreement post-date the agreement itself. But there are also circumstances where the parties want, for very good reasons, which are explained in our briefs and on the record in this case, to have the pretrial agreement be binding as possible immediately, that the entry into the stipulation of fact occurs at the time the pretrial agreement is accepted by the convening authority. And the government pointed to this paragraph, and I would just point you back to it. Paragraph 62 of the pretrial agreement says that it is binding from the moment the pretrial agreement is accepted by the convening authority on both the accused and the government. And, you know, as they noted, it is not a forbidden term to make, to limit the ability of the government to withdraw from a pretrial agreement. They could have negotiated for a window. They could have negotiated to say only performance after this agreement will count for 705 purposes. Instead, they concluded an agreement that said the moment this is signed to include this pretrial, the stipulation fact, that this is binding on the government henceforth. And that's what they did. They don't like that now. We understand that they have compelling reasons to not like that, but there were many opportunities that they could have exploited long before entering into this pretrial agreement, or to include into the pretrial agreement itself that could have avoided them having to come to you at this late date.
Can you, 1J149, I assume this is General Tall is speaking here?
I think that is, yes, correct, Your Honor.
Okay. He says, line 16, 17, we're going back to what we were doing last week. Counsel don't need to be present. You're obviously welcome to. So what does he mean what we were doing last week?
He's referring to Friday when the defense teams are forbearing, and that from participating in the proceedings, questioning witnesses, or having anyone other than.
Are they allowed if only Mr. Ali had filed the suppression motion? Does it work in these military commission cases that other defense counsel can show up and question witnesses for other defendants who didn't file the motion?
The rule is that all motions filed are automatically joined by co-defendants unless they actively unjoin those motions.
So my hypothetical, let's imagine there's only a motion by Mr. Ali to suppress. That's a hearing on his witness. Do other counsel have a right to show up and question that witness?
I generally do not think so, no. They might be able to object to assert individual rights that come along. But
even want to be there to observe.
Right? To observe, correct. But I would say, if nothing else,
somebody
that is.
I have a comment for you.
No? Oh, sorry. Okay, just probably tackling me to the ground. Yeah, this motion was jointly filed. They just wanted that to be clear. Yeah, I thought that.
That's better than where we were last week. What he meant by where we were last week.
But why I think that actually cuts significantly against the government in this context is because. The rule isn't substantially performed to your prejudice, performed fully. It's begun to perform. And to the extent withdrawing the motion to suppress, mm-hmm. part of beginning performance on that promise was to not question witnesses and to then henceforth treat it as only the motion of an individual defendant, which would ordinarily be the course when you did not or otherwise withdrew from a motion. I think, again, is just evidence that certainly Colonel McCall understood in the hurly-burly of a trial process to be performance, at least at the very beginning.
Next page, so much of this is almost Greek to me. The next page, 150, lines 14 to 16, this is
Mr. Stowers.
Stowers, who does he defend?
No, he's in Guantanamo right now.
Sorry, he's a defendant, Mr. Stowers?
No, Mr. Stowers is the representative, learned counsel for Mr. Muhammad.
Okay, so he says to the judge, you had mentioned before on August 2nd, that you compared this to the arrangement that we have with Mr. Brock on behalf of Mr. Bin al-Sheikh.
Mm-hmm.
What was that arrangement? Of course, the judge just says no, but I'm just trying to understand the framework.
I was thinking about what
the judge was doing.
So Mr. Bin al-Sheikh had been severed from the case due to mental incompetence. And so that's why earlier when Mr. Connell was having the colloquy with Colonel McCall about severance, and Mr. Bin al-Sheikh, you'll see his name pop up mm-hmm. a number of times. That's what they're talking about. It's like, is this actually a severing of the trial? Are we now treating,
what was the arrangement they had with Mr. Brock on behalf of Mr. Bin al-Sheikh?
So I believe Mr. Brock and I can be corrected by my counsel, but they could have someone at counsel table to essentially observe the proceedings, given the fact that if nothing else, Mr. Ben-Al-Shaib had been a defendant in that case and was still certainly under jeopardy. He's still charged under that case. He's just presently incompetent to stand trial.
All right. So what at least counsel for Mr. Muhammad is saying, the arrangement we agreed to last week was we get to sit there and observe.
Yes. So basically, and Colonel McCall explains this a little further as this particular hearing goes on, he says he would like to have essentially at least one lawyer from each defense team in court, primarily so that there's a line. He says at one point, so we have a line of communication to one another so that there's and to be clear, and I think this is actually a legally significant point, even though it's not evident necessarily from the record, is that in all of those subsequent hearings, the person, the body at the table in these hearings on behalf of the respondents in this case has not been the actual learned counsel, which is a specific requirement of the Military Commissions Act, military law.
But on the next page, then on 151, he says, this is the judge speaking now. Because he said, no, this isn't that situation. He said, this is like when Mr. Ruiz, who I think is one of the defense counsels.
Yes.
For. I think is he
For Mr. Hassawi, he's learning counsel from Mr. Hassawi.
And there's reference to this in the prior hearing, the August 1 hearing as well, that something rose up. Mr. Ruiz couldn't get down for a session and they were going to be arguing something and just allowed his team to not participate in those arguments and do it later. Right.
Yes.
And that maps on to what Judge McCall said on August 1 of, OK, you're just not part of this right now. And if the need arises, you'll participate in it later. So if this is what Mr. McCall, again, is saying, Judge McCall, excuse me, is saying he understood the arrangement on August 1 to be that you all are not participating because we got to sort out a lot of things here. So we're turning it into the Mr. Ali only hearing, at which point you then would not be forbearing.
To be clear, it's to treat. So what he's talking about specifically with Mr. Ruiz is Mr. Ruiz was not present. Mr. Ruiz is the learned counsel for Mr. Hassawi. So he's statutorily required to be present during all of the hearings.
Right. And that's why he said this again on August 1st. And he's saying it again here. This is what he thought he was setting up on August 1st. And that is. They need to be there. Then you know what? Then we're just that case is I'm not severing the cases, which is a bigger permanent
thing. Of course. Yeah.
What I'm doing is just turning this into not that defendant's day in court. It is Mr. Ali's day in court on the suppression hearing. I'm just setting those aside. Judges could do this. They could say for a variety of reasons, but say, so today now it's only a one person suppression motion. And this is where he's once again saying, that's what I'm doing. It's not that you're not allowed to be here. It's not that you're not allowed to do something. It's that we got to sort some things out here. And so I'm not going to make any decisions right now other than to make this only Mr. Ali's day.
But
this is a reaffirmation of that, because he talks about Mr. Ruiz not being able to come down out of his airplane flights or whatever it was. He has the same discussion of the analogy to the Mr. Ruiz case on August 1.
Right. But again, I want to emphasize that ordinarily, and I'm sure my colleague can explain this with more detail just from practical experience than I can. Ordinarily, not only must learned counsel be present, the accused must either be present or actively waive presence at a given hearing. And so what this arrangement is essentially de facto removing these defendants from the case without issuing formal severance the way they did in Mr. Ben-Al-Shaib's case. And so if I might, Your Honor, and so to say that it's Mr. Ali's day, it's a joint trial. And so if it's Mr. Ali and only Mr. Ali's day, well, then it's not any of the respondents' day. And they're essentially being excluded actively from the proceedings.
Excluded. It's just that it's not their hearing day. It's not even their day to make motions. And then on the next page, 152, this is Mr. Forwards again, the defense counsel, alluding to Mr. Ruiz's analogous situation. I guess he had a family emergency. So the record is clear that does not constitute any sort of participation in the proceedings or substantive hearings.
Right.
Merely observers, right? So they weren't
and then
participating. They just weren't participants in the hearing. on August 1 because the judge hadn't figured out what was going on yet.
Well, because they promised not to participate and the government, well, they did. And that's how the government.
That would mean it wouldn't be analogous to, I can't do anything because the counsel's not here. So we're just going to put that person's part of the trial aside today. Today won't be their day of trial because their attorney's not here and the attorney has to be here. It will just be this other person's day of trial, at which point you don't have a right procedure to show up and make objections and things like that.
But no, that's just, first of all, that's not really what's being contemplated here. But moreover, that would be impermissible under the rules precisely because the rules very clearly state that not only must the accused and their learned counsel be present at every hearing involving that accused, otherwise they're in like a getter's lack of counsel situation.
But that wouldn't apply if, like, back to my question, if Mr. Ali alone had filed a suppression motion, Mr. Ali alone had filed it.
It would. All proceedings must be attended by all defendants unless there is a specific motion to proceed either ex parte or
they're all co-defendants in a single proceeding.
That's correct. And again, I just want to foot stomp the next word out of Colonel McCall's mouth when Mr. Sowards, you know, very much, again, looking at the obligations under the pretrial agreement as understood, as explicitly stated at the August 1st hearing, he says that we want to make sure that nothing we're doing is construed as any sort of participation, essentially, because that would violate our obligations under the pretrial agreement. And Colonel McCall says, sure, right? This isn't sort of ambiguous what's happening and why people are doing what they're doing. They're doing it, they're forbearing from performing because they're obligated to forbear from participating. I'm sorry, I just...
I think we should hear from Mr. Ankle.
I apologize. Before that, can I just ask you a question?
Absolutely.
A bit more mundane statutory question.
I'm eager for a mundane statutory question at this point.
So this is 950G, sorry. So this is about whether the government could appeal. I'm looking at A, and could use some help understanding your view on it. We have exclusive jurisdiction over a final judgment rendered by a military commission, parentheses, as approved by the convening authority. And I know there's this whole procedure that the convening authority gets to look at final judgments and essentially ratchet down but not up.
Generally, it's the equivalent of entry of a final judgment by a district court.
They can't increase punishments or anything like that.
That's correct.
With the as approved by the convening authority be met if the convening authority opposed the entry of the plea and the entry of final judgment?
I want to make sure I understand your question.
So this is presumably something not foreseen by Congress when writing that. But there's a process where even after the military judge would impose sentence and would ordinarily be sort of final judgment in a civilian court, the convening authority has to sign off and could even adjust down, but not up.
That's correct.
Okay. But we're now in a situation where the convening, if we were to go forward under the theory that the government could appeal later, the convening authority, presumably now under no instructions, would be standing there saying, no, don't agree. Presumably wouldn't approve the final judgment. Could the convening authority just not?
To essentially pocket veto the final judgment approval?
I don't know what happens.
That has not happened, so far as I'm aware. The closest analog. none of this has happened before, but the closest analog, and I can offer this potentially whatever guidance it's worth, is there have been circumstances where the convening authority has approved final judgment, but has not then taken the step of referring the case automatically to the Court of Military Commission Review, because the way the appellate scheme is structured, the Court of Military Commission Review appeals are actually automatic. They're essentially part of the process. And the convening authority essentially, once finalization happens, has to sort of ministerially sign over the record to the CMCR. And there have been circumstances involving pleas where, for one reason or another, the defendant did not actually sign the waiver of appeal in the CMCR, and the convening authority nevertheless essentially pocket vetoed the record and refused to turn it over to the CMCR. I believe this actually came up in the Cotter case, in which I believe Your Honor was on Judge Wilkins. And the way that that has thus far been resolved, for whatever it's worth, is the Court of Military Commission Review actually did issue a writ of mandamus to the convening authority, because there it was a ministerial act to refer the record of trial to the Court of Military Commission Review. So that if we were in a...
The theory here, I think, is it doesn't go through the Court of Military Commission Review. It's that the government would come straight here on appeal. Is that right? That was how I understood the arguments.
Well, certainly nine...
We're going to have to mandamus the convening authority to approve
that
agreement judgment that it says, heck no, we don't approve.
Yeah,
that's where we are.
We're a bit down a garden path, but if you had a... No, I'm just doing my best with something that doesn't have a lot of historical support for it. But I do think if there was a situation where a convening authority was essentially pocket vetoing the final action, I think mandamus probably would be both available and probably appropriate in those circumstances, because it's a non-discretionary act. How they act, there is discretion embedded in the final judgment they make, but the entry of the judgment itself, that is sort of traditional obstructing the higher court's jurisdiction, sort of an in re United States, the long ago in re United States scenario where a lower court is just refusing to act. And
would there be a flip problem that if the convening authority did approve it, that would then stop the government from challenging the final judgment that was approved?
I
have to both approve it and say it was unlawful.
I don't think so. And again, we're in an area of uncertainty, but I don't think so, because there the question would be, is the judgment itself lawful? And that very much can turn on whether or not the convening authority behaved in a lawful or abused their discretion in some form or another. And so the convening authority's actions are not immune from review. It's just that those actions are the trigger ultimately for the jurisdiction of the court. And then first for the CMCR, but assuming CMCR is waived, which is required under the PTA, then any sort of petition for review in this court. Okay.
Maybe the government will be able to clarify that, their view on that, how that would work.
Okay. I hope that helps.
When you're out as well, I think. Do you have more questions? Sorry. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Rush.
Hey, Mr. Engel, I can't promise your 6 minutes will only be 6 minutes.
May it please the court. My name is Matthew Engel. I represent Waleed bin Attash, one of the three men who signed the pretrial agreements on July 29th. I want to focus on the merits, as we did in our brief, and particularly the fact that the secretary had no clear and indisputable right to withdraw. One thing we all agree on here is that Rule 705 does apply and does limit the convening authority, the secretary, the government writ large ability to withdraw, and that they cannot withdraw under that rule once the accused begins performance of the promises in the pretrial agreement. And there are two points I was hoping to make about that standard before sort of getting into the facts. And the first point is that beginning performance is by design a very low standard. Occasionally, I've heard the government sort of slip into arguments about prejudice and detrimental reliance. They did it in their briefing. They did it this morning. That is not the standard. That has been rejected as the standard, both by the drafters of Rule 705 when they created in the UCMJ, in the court martial system, they created the Rule 705, which then got adopted into the military commissions. They said they were doing that specifically to create a clearer line of when the right to withdraw ends, and that it was no longer detrimental reliance. And I've listened to hours of argument about this case today, and I haven't heard anybody talk about the Dean decision. And I really want to emphasize the United States versus Dean case that we cite and rely on extensively in our brief, because In that case, a 4-1 decision in the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, the highest military court in the country, interpreting the verbatim language out of RMC 705. They were interpreting the court-martial version.
Dean is not binding on this court.
Not binding, but I'm going to articulate why I think it should be incredibly persuasive to this court, because it is the highest military court in the land, and they were interpreting the exact same language that we have at issue here. And what CAF said in Dean is that the government concedes, and we agree, that the accused must only show detrimental reliance only if he did not begin performance on the agreement. So let's put that aside. Let's not focus on detrimental reliance. That is not the standard. The second reason I think that the second point I wanted to make about the standard, and the reason I think Dean is entitled to great respect, is that it is a military court interpreting military rules. There is no analog to RMC 705 in the Article 3 system.
So in Dean, though, there were other acts of performance.
There were three acts of performance identified in Dean.
Right, so.
Two of those acts took place before the convening authority accepted the pretrial agreement.
Dean doesn't provide any reasons for why something that occurred before an agreement was entered into could count as performance, which is a principle that is contrary to basic contract law.
I don't think it is, and I think this has been fleshed out quite a bit already this morning, but I'll just sort of throw my two cents in on top of that, which is, you know, the actual language of the pretrial agreement, I think this is important. This is not under seal. It's in paragraph 6 of our pretrial agreement. This is what it says.
Hang on, give me a second to get there.
Yes, Your Honor.
We have a lot of agreements.
It's in the seal.
Paragraph 6?
Yes, Your Honor. Paragraph 6 is what I'm about to read from.
That is unsealed, okay?
Yes, it is. The accused agrees to enter into the stipulation of fact included as attachment A to the pretrial agreement. He understands that he has an absolute right to refuse to enter into the stipulation of fact. However, he knowingly and voluntarily agrees to enter into the stipulation of fact. He understands that failure to enter into a stipulation of fact is a breach of a material term of the agreement. This is all forward-looking. This is all saying, this is a PTA, a binding agreement entered into by Mr. Benatosh and by the convening authority.
Even though paragraph 6 uses forward-looking language, the actions of the government and the parties here were that they entered into the stipulation of fact before the agreement was signed. So this language does look forward.
Sorry.
But when you look at attachment A, it's already been executed. The stipulation of fact has already been signed.
Yes.
And agreed to. So
absolutely. I'm with you 100%, which is exactly what happened in Dean. And what I will say is that it is the government who insisted on us signing the stipulation of fact before they would endorse the agreement.
So under ordinary contract principles, pre the signing of something, you know, the performance or, you know, pre-performance becomes part of the offer of the contract. It's not a promise for future action.
But this case is not governed by contract law. This case is governed by Rule 705, which talks about beginning performances of promises in the PTA. Now, the government can say, as it did in this case, we want those PTAs locked in up front. I think Your Honor, Judge Wilkins made this point. We don't want any dispute about those down the road. We want them here and now, today, black and white, signed, locked and loaded.
And so it's no longer a promise. It's already been done.
It is a promise. It's a promise that has already been fulfilled. And that means that once the convening authority accepts the PTA, which she did, and signs it, and it becomes binding on the parties, it is a promise that has been fulfilled, which I believe, Judge Millett, you were getting at that point earlier. It springs into existence. It's already there. That's exactly what happened. I see that I'm over time. I just want to make sure that I have the court's permission to continue.
Yes, please.
So that's exactly what happened here. The government is worried about maintaining its window or its safe harbor provision or whatever it wants to call it. Well, it can do that. All it has to do is not require the stipulation of fact to be signed prior to acceptance of the PTA. There's nothing in the rules that requires that to happen. There's nowhere anywhere in the MCA or in any of the rules or regulations that says the PTA should be done up front. They wanted that. They insisted on that. So we complied with that. What they can't do is have their cake and eat it too. What they can't do is say, we're going to make you promise. You're going to have to make this promise, and we're going to require you to do it up front, and we're going to keep that window of withdrawal.
It becomes part of the offer of the respondents. Because the government wouldn't enter into these pretrial agreements without the stipulation of facts. So it becomes part of the offer. Signing the stipulation of facts is part of the offer. It's not part of the performance.
I don't agree that it can't be both of those things, Your Honor. It's a promise.
How can something be in basic contract law both an offer and performance?
Again, one of my goals up here today, Your Honor, is to get us away from contract analogies.
Well,
this is not a contract case. This is a Rule 705 case. So the question is, how can something be both the fulfillment of a promise and something that's already occurred? Well, Dean says it can be. In fact, Dean says that it is. And that is a holding that really is entitled to a great deal of deference in this court.
So when we review a pretrial agreement's interpretation de novo, we shouldn't apply ordinary contract principles? We should just look to CAF?
I actually don't think there's any de novo review here at all. That's something I want to take issue with. I think this court should be looking at this petition under a doubly deferential standard of review. First, because the government has elected to proceed by way of writ of mandamus, which requires a clear and indisputable right, among other standards. But secondarily, as I started to say, because this is a question that is unique to military justice, and we cited in our brief on footnotes 66 and 68, page 21 of our brief, two Supreme Court cases, Noyd versus Bond and Middendorf versus Henry, that talk about the federal courts should be deferential to military courts when interpreting provisions which have no analogs in civilian jurisprudence. That's where we are, Your Honor. That's where we are. We are dealing here with a provision of military law that has no analog in Article 3, has no article in, I'll tell you, the Virginia state courts where I practiced for a long time. This is a military rule. So when the CAF, the highest military court in the land, says a promise can be fulfilled even if that action takes place before the PTA is executed, that should carry a lot of weight with this court because they are interpreting the military law. And so that's why I talk about this as sort of a doubly deferential standard that I ask this court to apply.
Dean didn't say that ordinary principles of contract law don't apply. It was just interpreting how there was performance in that case.
Yeah, well, yes.
It doesn't seem to me them saying we reject all application of general contract principles on, for example, when the contract was formed.
And I apologize if I made it sound as though I was saying a contract law could never apply to here.
You just said this is not a contract case. It's a Rule 705 case. And I don't know what to do with a Rule 705 case if we aren't interpreting.
And maybe
there was an agreement.
Maybe I overstated it. Mm-hmm. What I should say is our claim is not grounded in contract law. It's grounded in Rule 705. What Dean specifically did reject is the application.
This is not unlike. There's some wording similarities, including the absence of substantial performance. I get that. But this is not alien to contract law. This is what counts as formation, what counts as agreement, what counts as a performance before someone can withdraw. And so I don't understand I still don't understand why you're saying this is a Rule 705 case, other than that, you know, no substantial performance is required. This is just, we're just looking to see if there's beginning of performance.
That's exactly right, beginning of performance. I think the reason I'm saying that, Your Honor, is because we're not really in dispute about the other, about offer and acceptance and consideration and all sort of all the contract law stuff.
I was asking some questions that I had earlier about when did the contract come into existence and how did that timing map onto when the proposed stipulation of fact became the stipulation of fact.
Yeah, and to put precise dates on that, the contract by its own terms became binding when it was accepted by the convening authority. That was July 31st of 2024. So I know there's been a lot of back and forth about the sequence of events.
So July 31st is when the convening authority signed.
Yes.
But then the agreement obligates the defendants to enter into,
among other things,
stipulation of fact, lots of things.
But yep. Yes, Your Honor.
Is relevant here.
Yep.
Enter into a stipulation of fact.
Yep.
And failure to do so will breach the agreement. And so it assumes that there's something that's going to be done
when there is already an agreement that could breach it, and that could be not entering into a stipulation of facts. But if the whole premise of the agreement is that the stipulation of facts is fully entered into the moment an agreement is born, why would there then be an obligation to enter into a stipulation of facts under the agreement, and not doing so would be a breach of the agreement? How can you breach something that exists, that is fully performed at the moment the agreement is formed? How could there ever be a breach?
Oh, many ways.
Okay.
Many ways. And one of them, I think I stopped reading before I got to this part of paragraph 6. But what it goes on to say is that the accused understands he may not ordinarily attack, contradict, or otherwise challenge his stipulation of fact. Mm-hmm. Again, that's a forward-looking promise.
I know, but right? I'm talking about the phrase enter into a stipulation of fact, mm-hmm. and the sentence that says failure to enter into a stipulation of fact is a breach. I'm not talking about attacking. That comes after this. I'm
right. Okay.
Tell me how these sentences make sense if it's fully accomplished at the moment the agreement is formed.
Because we have fulfilled our promise at that point. Because
we can just cross out, he understands that a failure to enter into a stipulation fact is a breach of material term of this agreement, because that can never happen.
Well, it can happen in every other case except a one in which the government has required us to satisfy that. That's right.
Well, then why is it here? Don't talk about other contracts. In this very contract, it sounds like the argument is that he fulfilled his duty, his obligation,
yes.
to enter into a stipulation of fact the moment the convening authority signed off, and he didn't, you know, his counsel didn't throw body across the papers and say don't sign. All right. But at that moment, once the convening authority is signed, he was all done performing his duty to enter into a stipulation of fact. Is that correct?
Yes, that provision was satisfied.
Then why would we say in this very same contract that is predicated on that performance being completed the moment agreement is created, that there could ever then be a breach of that failure to enter into it?
Because we're talking about two different things here, right? We're talking about the PTA, which mm-hmm. is signed between Mr. Benetash mm-hmm. and the convening authority, in which mm-hmm. he promises to enter into a PTA. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, there's the actual stipulation. I think I might have misspoke there a minute ago. Meanwhile, there's the actual stipulation, which is negotiated and signed by Mr. Benetash and trial counsel. Convening authority doesn't sign the stipulation of fact. Convening authority signs only the pretrial agreement.
So the government just said, and I think this has to be right, just reading the plain text here, that given the last two paragraphs in this 62, complete agreement, including those addenda, is that when the convening authority signed the agreement, was the mm-hmm. same as signing the stipulation of facts.
I don't think I agree with that.
The convening authority is not bound by the stipulation of facts?
The convening authority is not a party to the stipulation of facts. The convening authority has accepted the stipulation of
facts. Well,
they
accepted a contract in which that is expressly a part of the agreement and is brought in fully as a part of the agreement. I don't know how you can sign an agreement and say this attachment is fully a part and hereby incorporated into this agreement and say, not part of my agreement.
Well, for example, right, we could have submitted an unsigned stipulation of fact as attachment A to the mm-hmm. pretrial agreements. Mm-hmm. And we could have said, we hammered this out, just like we actually did, spent years going back and forth and revising. And mm-hmm. I mean, it was a process.
Sure.
But instead of executing it on July 29th, which is what we did, mm-hmm. well, because that's what the government required us to do, we could have just sent that up to the convening authority as Exhibit mm-hmm. A. along with the promise to enter into that precise stipulation of fact, mm-hmm. right? Attachment
A. I get as a theoretical matter you could have, but I thought you said earlier that's not how they wanted it. They insisted. So you couldn't have just done that under this agreement. That's
right.
How they insisted this agreement would work.
Right.
And yet the agreement textually envisions a breach that can happen after the agreement is formed, and no one can tell me what that breach is. A breach by failing to enter into a stipulation of fact, and no one can tell me what that breach would be.
And I think the only point I'm trying to make to Your Honor is that there is another way that this could have played out. And I get your point. That's not what happened here. Totally agree with you on that. But there is another way this could have played out, which is that we could have and had been
hypothetically, but not literally.
But not literally.
Okay.
Yes, there is a way that this could have played out that would have required Mr. Benetash to sign the pretrial agreement.
That would have been a much easier case for me.
Yes, well, I don't know if it would have been easier for me or not, but I'll stew over that one for a while. But the bottom line here, and I really just want to come back to this, is that, you know, Dean already decided this. The government isn't arguing anything new here. Take a look at the dissent in Dean. It was a 4-1 decision. One judge agreed with the government. One judge agreed that you can't perform a promise before the agreement is signed.
No, I think we're all familiar with Dean.
Okay.
And recognize the extraordinary expertise of that court generally, but we're struggling. It's not binding on us. We're struggling to reconcile it with just contract law.
I think it is entitled to great respect. And the other point I would make about it, Your Honor, is that the government has, you know, it's been on the books since 2009. This is a 15-year-old decision. They understood that Dean existed as we're negotiating this and we're working out when a stipulation is going to be signed, et cetera. They know that the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces has held that a stipulation of fact signed prior to acceptance of the PTA is beginning of performance under Rule 705, at least under court-martial analog, which, again, is identical to the Military Commission Rule 705.
Go ahead. You have one last point?
Yeah, one last point that I wanted to make on that, because I think I heard you, Judge Millett, say something when I was sitting at counsel table that I thought was really kind of incisive and cut to the heart of this, which is we're flipping through some of the transcript pages, and I thought I heard you say, this is like Greek to me. I agree. You know, I came into the military commissions in June of 2022, and it was like Greek to me, too. This is foreign stuff. And I talked to my law partner, who I'm also married to, about this stuff all the time, and she looks at me like I'm speaking a foreign language. That's because these are military issues. That's because Rule 705 is a weird concept for those of us who have practiced in Article III courts and or state courts our whole career. We don't have an analog to it. And that's the reason I keep coming back, and I don't mean to be pedantic about it, but I do keep coming back to Dean and the importance of Dean. These issues have been rejected by a court that is immersed in these military standards and issues.
Another question? Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
We'll give the government 5 minutes for rebuttal, and then after that, we'll have a reset or sealed proceeding.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will not tax the court's patience long. I think the court
has taxing you all.
I think the court has our argument on most of the main points covered, and I just wanted to address quickly three things and then reiterate my request for an extended stay should the court deny relief.
Okay, I don't know that you need to reiterate that. I think we understand the request.
I will consider it reiterated then.
Save some airtime on that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I will let you make your points, but can you answer my 950G question, 950GA question about if a predicate for a government appeal coming here, even let's assume they've all signed their waivers like they're supposed to, as approved by the convening authority, what happens if the convening authority dissents from the whole darn thing?
I think
it would be a procedural approval that would bring it here.
I don't know, Your Honor. The convening authority has a requirement under Section 950B to take action on the sentence. And as you noted correctly, he can dial it down but not up. I think the world in which this would be relevant is one in which...
Sorry, you said is there a new convening authority now?
I'm sorry, she. Okay. She. The world in which this would be relevant is one in which we have already been ordered by the military judge to abide by the pretrial agreements, said we can't withdraw. And under that agreement, I don't know that the convening authority would be allowed to withhold action as opposed to finishing the process. Mm-hmm. This is very uncharted territory. And I think to the extent that this is offered as an adequate alternative to relief, all of these questions only underscore its inadequacy.
I'm trying to understand about the government's appeal rights, because if the convening authority, if it's a final entry of sentence person, final entry of judgment in these cases, and given the authority to just reduce charges or reduce sentence, that therefore, you know, government's never going to appeal based on that, presumably. I'm just trying to understand how this is. This is the question about whether this is an avenue for the government, given this special role and what the convening authority would have to do here and whether that would have any consequences for the, it's almost like a district judge signing off on a magistrate judge's decision and then saying, but I dissent. Then what are we supposed to do about that?
I'm not sure, Your Honor, and I am not sure that the convening authority, if what we are talking about is a scenario in which the convening authority would violate the military commission's order to abide by the pretrial agreement.
This is whether you could appeal later. So I'm assuming that,
we've carried out the pretrial agreement.
Propose that we could say that you all can review that, you can all challenge this later. And so then you'd go forward, the court would accept the pleas, presumably with convening authority of the government standing there saying, you know, we dissent, we object, or we don't agree for the record.
Mm-hmm.
And then you would go forward and have the whole sentencing hearing and then an entry of sentence by, assume it's a military judge, or is that going to a panel?
I believe the panel must select the sentence.
Okay.
Has discretion.
Yes. Military jury will select the sentence, and then the military, presumably you'll make whatever arguments you make there, and then the military judge will enter that sentence and then refer it to the convening authority to do the final entry?
Yes, and under 950B, the convening authority has to take action on the sentence.
Okay, and so then the convening authority would have to do what, which would then, under the argument, as I understand it, would then get, and then the waivers have been signed, would then allow the government to appeal.
I think the theory here is that the government would, after the waiver, would be allowed to appeal essentially what was its own convening authority's decision entered under duress, more or less. There are real questions, I think, about whether or not we can do that under the text of 950G.
If the convening authority refused?
If the convening authority refused, I imagine you might see someone back here on a mandamus petition again.
Mm-hmm.
And I am very loath to endorse a route that involves a government official defying a military judge's order. If we have been ordered to abide by the agreement, I think that would put the convening, and if we do it, we might lose our appeal rights. I think we are putting the convening authority in an impossible position. Okay. This relates to one, I don't want to cut off your honor's question, but this relates to one of the points I wanted to make about the adequacy of the highly speculative and potentially inadequate avenues of relief that I think have been posited here. When my friend on the other side says 3 years sounds good, that's pretty quick in the course of things. I want to make sure the court understands what we are contemplating here, which is that if the court denies relief on the theory that we can appeal on the back end and that we should go through the pretrial agreement steps, go through the sentencing in front of the jury that will select a sentence, and then we'll the convening authority and then the waiver and then the appeal. What we are talking about is victims' families making statements through a process that they want to bring them finality, that this court will have said, no, these might not be the final proceedings. And I am not here to diminish the pain or sincerity of any of the victim families' filings in this case, nor do I want to be disrespectful to the sense of betrayal that other victims' families felt at the idea that the respondents would be allowed to take a plea deal. What I am saying is that as a matter of both the adequacy of the alternative route and the overall equities of the situation, I urge the court not to defer acting on the underlying merits of the dispute here about the secretary's withdrawal and put everyone through a potential 3 more years of uncertainty for a proceeding that we think shouldn't happen and that in this hypothetical, the court would say on the back end should never have happened. That was one of my 3 points, but I do have 2 more. One's a little more in the weeds, which is I think Mr. Parody referred to paragraph 57. that paragraph remains under seal. This relates to our request on scheduling.
Talk about that in the sealed session if you want to just save your point, or do you want to do that now?
I just want to say that there are the only JA, which is public, pages that they cite, I think, are JA 233 through 235. Mm-hmm. It is only the prosecution making a request at those pages. And the citations I wanted to provide to the court were in respondents' later motions to enter, to schedule the plea hearings. This is after the secretary's withdrawal. They themselves referred to that as the prosecution's or Mr. Trivett's request. They did not seem to think that it was part of a joint endeavor at that point. And this is at AE 955C.
Sorry, JA or
AE, this is appellate exhibit. It's on the docket of the underlying proceeding.
Mm-hmm. What's the pages?
I can find you the specific pages in a minute. The other two sites are, because there are three, one for each respondent, AE 956F and AE 957B. And they describe what happened at those.
Sorry, I missed the first one. I got 956F and 957B. What was the first one?
The first one was 955C. And it's not hard to find. It's at pages between 1 and 3 of each of these. They refer to those statements as either the prosecution's request or Mr. Trivett requested. It may be hard to pull those filings from the docket, not because they're sealed, but just because they haven't gone through the normal security. It takes a little while for things to be made public on the docket after a security review. I can provide those filings to the court. I will do that.
Obviously, defense counsel can provide any counter filings that they wish to.
Okay.
Other pages I think we should look at.
And I think we've covered most of the things I wanted to get to on rebuttal, Your Honor. Thank you very much for indulging me.
Any other questions for now? Okay. All right. Thank you. We'll take a brief recess and close the courtroom.